documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
So just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, along with Vicki Davis, here with you on this 16th of December 2017. And it's nice to have you with us once again as we document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy, and a lot going on, and we'll get right to it here in just a moment. Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning.
Yeah, what's going on in your neck of the woods there?
Oh, just freezing cold, and aside from that, everything is pretty much the same.
Yeah, we're in the process. We have Vicki on the phone today because of the Skype issues last week, and we're in the process of trying to find some kind of viable alternative, since for some reason Skype, and we're hoping it's just a Skype issue, but the kind of this disruptions and having to ask her to repeat things is kind of a challenge for us, but we'll overcome, as the civil rights people like to say.
I just looked outside and we had the first snowfall.
Oh my goodness, boy, are you lucky!
I did.
You know, we've been getting clobbered.
It's just a dusting, but it's enough to make the roads white.
Well, we've got everything white here. I mean, it's just a business. This has been a never-ending assault, and never-ending. I mean, we have gotten so many inches, and we're getting more today. We're supposed to get, Ingham County is. I think Ingham County is under a winter weather advisory, but we just had one wave after another come through here, and it's not even officially fall yet. That's the funny thing about it.
Well,
I mean, it's not officially winter.
You're going to have a white Christmas.
Yeah, I guess for those that are praying for that, you know, for me, I don't care if we ever had another white Christmas again. I couldn't care less.
Well, it looks better on TV than it is living through it, but I do like it, I have to say.
Yeah, well, if you have to go out and travel in it, it takes the fun out of it. If I could actually sit and watch it through my window and never have to go anywhere, yeah, it'd be great.
Yeah, but, I suppose so, huh?
But it's a part of it. I think I'd rather deal with the snowstorms though than deal with the hurricanes and other severe weather that comes with from living in some of the southern states anyway. Not all of them, of course, but
yeah, me too. Those tornadoes, I think, and hurricanes are pretty darn scary.
Yeah.
I'll take the snow any day.
Yeah. Well, we've got some interesting developments on the Bundy case. It's pretty fascinating that we have... I think we told people last week that some of the Bundys were able to be released last week, and... the judge in the case was evidently angry at the government, the prosecution, for withholding evidence. And I think now we got somewhat of a clue as to the extent of what was going on inside the Bureau of Land Management. The document that has come to light, you want to talk about that?
No, go ahead. You've got it there, so...
Well, I don't want to read it because it's 18 pages. I read it last night. Basically, what it boils down to is the Bureau of Land Management apparently has a culture of adolescence. Wouldn't you say that's fair, Vicki?
adolescence, but also criminality. It's the kind of culture, anything goes culture, as if they have no constraints whatsoever. They can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
Like children left home alone, you know.
Yeah, nobody's guarding the hen house here. These people are running roughshod. They make childish comments, very unprofessional, very vulgar, the kind of thing that you would expect from an elementary school boy, only a bunch of elementary school boys. They are, they're children. I mean, there's no other way to say it. But now it's gotten to the point where they have jeopardized the case, because what they've done is, you know, with their comments that have been caught on their body cameras and the footage that's leaked out, and this whistleblower has come forward now from inside the agency because they were let go as a result of they're trying to get some of this stuff to stop. This person has repeatedly questioned his superiors and tried to get them to deal with the problem. But the superiors are a part of the problem. And it sounds like the whole agency just needs to be purged. And we're kind of talking around it, but I will put the link in the show notes for people to read the thing for themselves. It's a pretty fascinating read, albeit somewhat depressing, to think that we can have federal agencies with this level of a lack of professionality. But this is the thing is it's all this is not just, I'm telling you folks, this is not just the Bureau of Land Management though. This kind of thing permeates all of the federal government. Law enforcement, anyway. Go ahead, Vicki.
Yeah. I was going to say what was most disturbing to me was that the BLM special agent in charge had a kill list, and the Bundys were on it. And, I mean, you know, when you have a government agency that sets out to assassinate people, as they did with Lavoie Finicum, then you've got real serious problems in your government, which we already knew. I mean, it's not like this is a surprise.
Right.
The only surprising part of it is to actually have documentation on it.
Yeah. Yeah, and this guy's been retaliated against because of his desire to bring forth the issue, and this is not somebody that's in favor of Clive and Bundy, but he just wants the nonsense to stop.
Yeah, and well, and his name is Larry Wooten. He's a BLM agent, and Wooten was also involved in the Sugar Pine Mine episode. Sugar Pine Mine, I forget what state it was in, Montana or. I can't quite remember, but the BLM was trying to shut down a pair of old miners that, you know, they had a mining claim. They'd been mining it for quite a while, and the government tried to shut them down.
Mm-hmm.
And the Idaho 3% were there kind of mediating between the government and the miners to make the government follow the law.
Imagine
because
that.
They were not following the law. And so I think it ended up that BLM went away. But, you know, so the practice of using essentially what is terrorism against property owners is something that has become part of the culture, apparently, with the BLM.
Yeah. Yeah, this seems to be the modus operandi. And there's other people that have come out now who are suing the FBI. Now, of course, we're talking about the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, but the FBI... Now, there are certain defendants, Ricky Loveline and Stephen Stewart, have been acquitted. Now they're turning around and suing the FBI for damages, which, you know, good for them. I think it's great that they're doing that.
Well, I hope that everybody involved in the whole Bundy situation is able to turn around and sue the government, because we can't have a law enforcement agency that is lawless.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that they're all lawless anymore. I mean, you got the FBI routinely setting up acts of terrorism. And before I mentioned the term law enforcement, I hate to even use that term in conjunction with these federal agencies. Because, really, I mean, from a constitutional standpoint, how many of them are constitutional? You know, I don't see that they have any real authority. But they're doing what they're doing outside of the Constitution.
Well, I'm not opposed to law enforcement. I wouldn't challenge their constitutionality, because if they didn't exist, we would have to create them. But I do strenuously object to criminality. They should be above reproach. You know, if you're going to be law enforcement officers, you better, you know, follow the law yourself first.
Well, the worry here, I mean, I understand, I think I know what you're saying about we would have to create them, because you do have to have the ability to fight cross-border criminal activity. But the problem with federal law enforcement, quote-unquote, is that it amounts to a standing army. I mean, that's really what it gets down to, and that's the concern, I think.
Well, I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. Because the Department of Justice and the Defense Department signed a memorandum of understanding to cooperate in the development of technologies, non-lethal technologies, but really the cooperation was for the purpose of supposedly protecting critical infrastructure, but what it actually turns out to be is building the police state.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the military and the Department of Justice integrating together in a consolidation of power. And so anytime you have consolidation of power like that with no checks and balances on it, you're going to have major problems, and that's what we have. Even the Congress can't get information out of the Department of Justice because they throw up this national security curtain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we should not have a national security curtain on domestic law enforcement.
Right. Yeah, I
agree. Even at the federal level.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, did you hear that Jingle Bells is now racist?
Well, I'm not surprised. You know what? I can't stand those idiots. I wouldn't even... These Marxists...
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Everything is racist. If you sing, you know, Bing Crosby's White Christmas, it's racist. Everything is racist. If everything is racist, then nothing is racist.
Yeah.
Because it kind of cancels out, you know?
Yeah, there's also somebody saying that the obsessive tidiness is now racist. So it's the root,
well,
the root cause of racism.
Well, I can go along with that. Down with excessive tidiness.
Yeah, this cultural Marxism thing, this is just, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about this, how bad things have gotten, and we chronicle on, if I can spit it out here, we chronicle this on the show. Because it's to me, it is a demonstration of a society in collapse when the people in that society can't seem to function. I mean, this is what cultural Marxism is all about, deconstructing the fabric of society to the point where society cannot function. And we are here we're at this point, and this is being pushed along. It started with the homosexuals being pushed to marry homosexuality. That was one of the current communist goals, is to promote homosexuality as a normal, healthy, alternative lifestyle. And they have successfully achieved that, I would argue. Because now we can look everywhere. A lot of these millennials, but Generation Xers as well, accept homosexuality. Even people older than that, to a certain extent, although a lesser extent, accept homosexuality as being normal now, as being something that should be promoted. Isn't it great that two men are getting married and two women are doing their thing too? So that's accepted. Now we've got, so when you open the door for that, you open the door, the floodgates literally are open for just anything now. Anything goes. And so now we have stories like this.
This woman is engaged to her chandelier. Seriously, she has a ring to prove it.
Just like anybody who falls in love with somebody else, they want to be close to them. And so I enjoy being close to my chandeliers.
33-year-old Amanda Liberty owns more than two dozen fancy light fixtures.
I've admired them for years. I've loved the way that they've looked. I've loved the way that the light catches on the little crystals. And I've just loved them in general. I think they're beautiful things.
The chandelier that stole her heart is named Lumiere, after the candelabra in Beauty and the Beast.
This is Lumiere.
Enchanté, chérie.
But since she explains she's in an open relationship with the chandeliers, she sleeps cuddled up next to a different one each night. Amanda realizes she's unique and is proud of her story.
I think it's good in the world to have a bit of variety and have different types of people. If we're all the same, the world would be a really boring place.
Yeah, so here you have people trying to marry things. And
did you notice that she has a British accent?
Yeah.
A lot of this ridiculous stuff comes out of Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's being pushed upon us. It's being pushed upon us. And I think this woman is either an attention seeker. Obviously, she's an attention seeker, because how would Inside Edition have gotten a hold of her information anyway in the first place? So I think this is a marketing thing.
Oh, it is. It's all strategic. It's cultural Marxism and you know, I don't even pay much attention to it because it's stupid. You know, it's just stupid.
It is stupid for you and me. But what they're doing here is literally, like you said, it's cultural Marxism, so we ignore it at our peril. That's the problem. We can laugh at it and think it being harmless, but the difficulty here, of course, is that this is designed to change society. And let's go back to our discussion a few weeks ago with the professional cuddlers. Now we have a situation with colleges using Care Bears to comfort stressed out students. There was a dorm at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, recently put up a display featuring Care Bear characters offering advice for grumpy or stressed out students. And
now that worries me because it is bringing college students down to the level of children.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, a college student is at the age where they should be becoming adults.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for them to have... I when I was that age, if somebody had given me a Care Bear, it would have floored me, absolutely floored me, you know.
It should be an insult. And I think to the student that spotted it and reported it to campus, what was it? Campus Reform, I think, is what. Campus Reform. They were very insulted by it. So there are you know, some students out there that do still have the cognizant ability to think, and realize what this is. But, you know, all of this is growing out of this affective education system. For years, you know, I mean, schools not, you know, having sports events and, oh, we can't keep score now because we don't want somebody to be insulted by, you know, if they happen to lose. School is supposed to prepare you for real life. And when the schools are coddling and worrying about your feelings all the time, I mean, that's just, unfortunately, and I hate to say it, but even this anti-bullying stuff, nobody likes to be bullied. I hate bullies. I despise bullies. In fact, I think that's really one of the reasons why I'm doing what I do today, is because the biggest bully is the federal government. I think that's where a lot of your bullies graduate. You know, the A students graduate to bully from the federal government. The lower grade students, you know, a lot of times they turn out to be somewhat decent human beings later on in life after they realize what a jerk they were. But the point is that I despise bullies, and we have nothing. We have a whole. But as the point I was going to make is that with bullies, a lot of times being bullied in school, it is a part of the social phenomenon. It is a part of preparing you for real life, how to deal with social situations. And no, it's not pleasant, and I'm not endorsing bullying, don't get me wrong. But it does give you a certain level of skill. Hardships, while they're never pleasant, prepare you for more difficult hardships down the road. You learn how to deal with situations. Yes, it's a part of it. That's what I'm saying. And
it's all part of the process of growing up. That's,
yes,
you know, but they don't allow our children to grow up. And by growing up, that means accepting the fact that some people are smarter than you, some people are better than you, some people are more attractive than you are. You know, go down the list. Now, in one of those things, you might be at the top. But everybody has to deal with whatever their gifts are, whatever their deficiencies are in life, everybody has to deal with it. And this whole movement towards making everybody the same, it's fake. It's false. It's not true.
Right.
And I don't think we do our young people any favor by trying to make it true when it isn't.
Yeah, exactly. I completely agree. This other thing that has developed in recent weeks, how long has this been going? It's been going on for a little more than a month now, I think a couple months maybe. And I'm talking about this all this sexual harassment stuff, the gropings. Every week, seems like every day sometimes, we're hearing about another case of different people being outed for gropings that may have happened recently or may have happened, you know, 40 years ago. And of course, we were talking last week about Roy Moore, and he lost his campaign on Tuesday. But another politician who has who was accused of, I think, sexually assaulting a 14-year-old. He's a Kentucky state representative. His name is Dan Johnson.
We continue to follow the shocking death of a Kentucky lawmaker, Dan Johnson. Good afternoon. I'm Juliana Valencia. The Bullitt County coroner confirms Dan Johnson's death as suicide, adding his official cause of death was a single penetrating gunshot wound to the head. His death comes one day after he held a news conference. He was responding to allegations of molestation from a report just released by the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. WHAS 11, Sarah Wagner is following the developments for us today. And Sarah, this case, it's reaching far past the Commonwealth.
It really is, Juliana. The news of Dan Johnson's death is making headlines across the country, and the impact is certainly felt here locally, with many lawmakers reacting to it with statements on social media. And just a few days ago, there were plenty of calls for him to resign after claims came out he molested a 17-year-old girl back in 2014. Now, Facebook and Twitter are chocked full of messages of condolences for his family and friends. Details of his death are still limited, but here's what we know so far.
Oh, come let us adore him.
This is the last video in public that most people saw of State Representative Dan Johnson. He stood before his congregation and TV cameras on Tuesday to deny claims he molested a teen girl 4 years ago. Wednesday night, a post on Dan Johnson's Facebook page signaled to someone something was not right. It's since been taken down, but it read in part, "The accusations from NPR are false, and God knows the truth. Nothing is the way they make it out to be. 9/11, 2001, NYC, WTC, PTSD 24/7. 16 years is a sickness that will take my life. I cannot handle it any longer. It is one this life, but heaven is my home." Police say that person called them concerned about the state representative after seeing that post, and that's when they jumped into action.
We did ping his phone and got a general vicinity, and then we obviously started that way and was able to locate the vehicle.
That took them here to the Greenwell Ford Bridge in Mount Washington.
He drove his car over the bridge, pulled over to the side of the road, stopped, got out, and standing in front of his vehicle from the way the scene looked when I got here.
Officials have confirmed Johnson died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. His sudden death shocking everyone and leaving the community full of questions and emotions.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there since we got the bottom of the hour break. But this thing is now gotten to the point where people are committing suicide because of these allegations. I think we have to make sure we keep in mind, whenever these allegations are made, they are allegations until they're proven. We are innocent until
they're
proven.
They're all allegations for political purpose.
Right. Let's take a break and we'll comment when we come back.
If you have a heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
With Government America News this hour, I'm Darren Weeks. France's President Emmanuel Macron has said that he wants to run his country like a startup company in Silicon Valley. In an entrepreneurial conference in June, Macron stated that he envisioned France as a startup nation and has since stared down labor unions to begin market reforms. Some are saying Macron could become the model leader of global governance at a time when the United States is in withdrawal. The Washington Post writes that technocracy, more than anything else, has shaped the new president's governing style. The Communist Chinese are developing a system of facial recognition that will be able to identify anyone, anywhere, instantly. Shanghai-based Yaitu Technology has developed Dragonfly Eye to scan nearly 2 billion photographs that have been logged in the country's national database. The company says it is using the technology to track down criminals, but the same technology could be used to track down enemies of the state. State officials in North Carolina are pushing their residents to get their driver's licenses replaced with one that meets the requirements of the federal Real ID law before October 2020. Federal facilities nationwide, along with airport security, will begin enforcing tougher security standards requiring the new driver's licenses for access.
Congress passed the Real ID Act in 2005. The law pressures states to get certain documents before issuing a driver's licenses or identification cards and to incorporate anti-fraud measures in the licenses or cards. Deadline for compliance with the Real ID Act has been extended in the face of protests from states concerned about the feasibility of some aspects of the law and critics who say the Real ID amounts to a national ID card. And Interior Secretary Ryan Zenke revealed on Thursday that he has fired four senior managers at the Interior Department for inappropriate conduct, including sexual harassment. That's the news this hour.
One of the most popular movies during the Christmas season is the old favorite, It's a Wonderful Life. It's the story of George Bailey, a compassionate but dejected businessman who is ready to give up on life when his guardian angel, Clarence, intervenes. Clarence shows him life as if George had never been born, and George discovers that for all his supposed mistakes and failures, he has brought joy and life to countless people. It really is a wonderful life, and not just on TV. Each and every person has so much potential for good, and nowhere is this potential greater than with an unborn child. This Christmas and always, please work to preserve the wonder of life for the unborn and their mothers. This has been a perspective on life from National Right to Life. For more information, visit our website at nrlc.org. That's nrlc.org.
Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website. That's www.governamerica.com. My email address, radio@governamerica.com. Vicki, you want to go ahead and give your information out?
Yeah, I have two websites, www.channelingreality.com and thetechnocratictyranny.com.
All right.
And my email address is eyeswideopen@channelingreality.com.
All right, very good. I know that I wanted to get into the NAFTA renegotiations today, if we can. But there's a few things I wanted to cover just before we get to that. In fact, I've been wanting to talk about this for quite a while. I had a few things to discuss because I do have some concerns that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is being rolled into the NAFTA document. And one of the things that I'm really concerned about is the complete lack of transparency within the negotiation process. And it seems like, just like with the TPP and with the original NAFTA negotiations, everyone is being shut out, except the corporate interests, of course.
Well, yeah, that's because I want to comment on one of those news items that you read.
Yeah.
About France becoming the, quote, first commercial state.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a guy who appears on InfoWars. His name is Ted Malik. He said the same thing about the United States, becoming the first commercial nation. And I would like everybody to think about that, because if you have a nation that is a corporate commercial state, then you're living in a system of feudalism, and you don't have any rights under a feudalistic system.
Right.
And that's really where they're going with these trade agreements. The trade agreements were never about trade. They were about creating an international system of law. That's what they're about.
Yeah, and what is the international system of law? It is the new economic world order.
Yes, it is.
People don't realize that the new world order is an economic fascist model. It is a corporate dominant world order. The corporations are going to be running the world order.
Right, and going back to Great Britain at the turn of the 20th century, the Organization of Businessmen made a deal with the Carnegie Foundation, and their arrangement was a plan for elimination of nation states and for corporations to be in charge of economic activity and non-governmental organizations to be in charge of social issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this plan goes way back, and you can trace it right forward. I have traced it from back then forward. And if people don't understand the difference between a commercial state and a nation under a constitutional system, then God help us.
Yeah.
You know?
God help us indeed. Yeah. Did we finish talking about the... I think you wanted to comment on the death of the Kentucky senator.
Yeah, that makes me feel really bad. This whole thing about these women coming forward years afterward, and I don't care if it's 2 years later or 3 years later, but particularly now, they are doing it for a political purpose.
Well, in his case, I think it was, I think they said in that news report that it was 4 months later, and so his case might actually be different, and I don't know. Again, I'm not going to say it happened or didn't happen. I don't know if he's guilty or not. But broadly speaking, my concern is, with all of these allegations, where we may be heading is to a point where nobody is going to be free to make a pass at somebody else. I mean, let's face it, this is how normal human relationships take place. Not groping and molestations. That's not what I'm suggesting. But broadly speaking, with a lot of these allegations, somebody, you know, some of these things are just as non-threatening as a hand on the shoulder or, you know, shoulder massages and things. I mean, there have been some that have been serious and some that have been not so serious. But my point is that we're getting to a point, I'm afraid, where nobody's going to be allowed to say anything to anyone that's personal or to... you know, offer a hug or, you know, even offer a compliment. Some people are even afraid now to offer compliments because it might be construed as placing the party that's being complimented in a situation where I'm being sexually harassed. And they're afraid of being reported or afraid of being reprimanded in some way. So you've got this real threat now that the culture, and this is what we're talking about here, is how cultural Marxists morph society to their end. My concern is where we're headed with all of this is an interference with normal human relationships, how they're formed, because let's face it, many times, many people that are married today are married because men pursued the women. Okay? Now, I'm not suggesting that people should be, you know, in uncomfortable situations. And this is where it gets very delicate. But and I'm certainly not trying to be insensitive to the plight of women and you know, I can just anticipate what some people think. But this is a part of the normal process in many respects of how people form relationships. And my concern is that we're headed toward a condition in our country where normal human relationships, interpersonal relationships that have been formed since the beginning of time, will no longer be allowed because somebody might be offended or somebody might feel threatened in some way that you're making an advance on them. Am I just overblowing the situation?
Well, no, you're not overblowing it. You're a bit overly sensitive, you know. I'm really angry about it. I'm angry that feminists are destroying what is a natural biological process, you know, and mm-hmm. and even for young girls that get, you know, that where an older man makes a pass at them, young girls have the ability to say no, the same as an older woman. When I was 14, a friend of mine's father made a pass at me. And, you know, what I did about it, I scurried off like a little rabbit, and I never again
put myself in a situation
where I was alone in a room with him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the solution, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't need anybody to fix it for me. I fixed it myself. And women, young girls, are perfectly capable of fixing it themselves. And if they're not, then that's when they go to the police. That's when they go to their parents.
Yeah.
And you take care of it right at the moment.
Right. 40 years.
You don't wait 5 years down the road and then say, oh, you know, he made a pass at me.
That's my biggest thing about this whole thing is some of these allegations have gone back so many years, sometimes decades, and they come out of the woodwork. And I get it. Some people are concerned about losing their jobs or you know, having it adversely affect their career. But I don't know.
Well, that's how you know it's for political purpose.
Yeah, and the biggest thing...
And they bring it out 5 years later. Yeah. It's for a political purpose, not because the woman was hurt, not because there was anything out of ordinary life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the biggest thing with me is...
It makes me so angry.
I know. The biggest thing with me is...
They're doing this to men.
And what purpose, other than what I've outlined here, could it be? Except to promote women above men, which we know the United Nations wants to do.
I think I did mention that 1995 conference in Beijing,
mm-hmm.
where they talked about the position of women in globalization as if women are going to lead everything. And quite frankly, I don't want women leading everything. You know, some women are good at leading. Most of them are not.
I'm not going to touch that. I. You can get away with saying things like that. Tell you what, we got a call on the line. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm here. Hello, good morning, Vicki.
Well, hello here.
Good morning.
No. What's that?
I said, hello here.
Oh,
you said I'm here. So I said, hi, here.
I'm here.
It's a bad
John.
Joke. Yeah, I know, okay. John. Go ahead. Anyway, what's on your mind?
What it's boiling down to, guys, is this, okay? We know that eventually they're going to make it where you're going to have federal permission to reproduce. So in order to keep yourself from a lawsuit or some you're going to have to go on a list that you're thinking about reproducing, and you're open to... flirting, or you're open to being approached by the member of an opposite sex or the member of a same sex, and inanimate objects like your previous, they can't make any claims. You know, this woman in England, I guess this lamp lights up her life or something, and she's decided she's going to marry it. So who proposed, her or the lamp?
Yeah.
You know, this is craziness.
It is crazy.
Aaron, you and I have talked before, you're going to have permission to reproduce in the quote, natural method, you're
mm-hmm.
going to have their permission. But if you want to go to a clinic and be inseminated, or you want to hack your body and be injected or implanted with synthetic biology that they're developing to make some kind of a hybrid transhuman, posthuman mix, that'll be okay. They don't have a problem with that. What they're doing is, I believe, is preparing people to be totally controlled, because bear in mind, the human race is the enemy to the people that are running this place.
Yep.
That's what it boils down to. And is it cynicism? Absolutely. Is it overly cynical? I don't think so. Because they want to control, we know, they want to control every aspect of your life, every aspect of your death, and every aspect of who they allow to be born into this world.
Yep.
So if you want to protect yourself from being sued or from having your career destroyed, you're going to have to go on a list and say, look, I'm open to this, and everyone's going to have a little green tag or something around their neck that says you can ask me for a date.
Yeah, you know,
the way I met my wife was eavesdropping.
John, I'm
the way I met my wife was eavesdropping. I heard her saying she was going on a trip and she needed the oil changed in her car, and I looked behind me and I thought, she's awful pretty. I wonder if I offer to change her oil if she'll go out with me. And it worked. 39 years we've been married.
Yeah.
But eventually it's going to be, I dare not ask anyone, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why kids are going to be doing what they're doing.
Well, I look at George Orwell's 1984. If you look at the interpersonal relationships in that book, and it seems like more and more the elites, the establishment who are engineering society, are viewing that book as an instruction manual, because all of society seems to be following the pattern of that book. But if you look at that book, the way the interpersonal relationships work, I mean, it was illegal to have an interpersonal relationship, basically. People could not have sexual relations. One of the revolutionary acts that they committed in the book was going off meeting and spending time with each other in a very intimate way. So intimacy was pretty much outlawed. Yeah. Everybody's a comrade, and this is communism. This is how communist societies work. The state is your lover.
To me, it's got satanic roots and satanic origins. Eventually, we're going to have a ministry of reproduction, okay? If you've read...
No, it's a ministry of love.
Ayn Rand. Yeah, if you've read Ayn Rand's book, Anthem, it's the same deal in Anthem. You know, there was a man and a woman that met, and then come to find out, everyone had their job, and to go outside of your job was literally a revolutionary act. It could cost you your life. And that's what we're boiling down to now, because this whole idea of post-human existence is what their plan has been for all time, but especially since the technocratic movement in the 20s. They, you know, we're in the way. We're useless eaters. And it's this whole Luciferian hive mentality where we see that the beehive is a symbol of the Illuminati. So we're worker bees, people. That's all they look for. So when the need is not there, when machines can do the job that you and I do, according to Jordy Rose, better than we can do it, everything on earth, these people are saying, you know, that link that I sent you, computers can do everything that mankind can do better. They don't have a need for us. If he can build the machine or build the entity to do the work and sell it for 15, but he's only got 10 in it, the company doesn't have to pay $100,000 a year to someone that has to eat and have a place to sleep. They can just stay at work. And it sounds outrageous, but if your listeners have not looked at Jordy Rose's comment in Edmonton back in June or July, they need to watch it.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, John.
Elon Musk is saying about these. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got the clip right here. I did watch it.
So we had I'm going to talk about aliens.
Huh? What'd you say?
Blow some people's minds. I don't know if Vicky's... I said blow their minds. Play it.
All right, hang on.
So we had I'm going to talk about aliens. So my previous company was D-Wave. I'll just show you a couple things. We built what are still the world's only quantum computers that you can buy. One of the interesting things that's happened from the D-Wave story is there's this gigantic conspiracy that's arisen on the internet.
Okay, before I go on here, I want to point out, I should have set the stage. This Jordy Rose is a guy, he's the founder of D-Wave, which builds quantum computers. And he also founded a separate company, which I guess he's the head of now, called Kindred. They're into the artificial intelligence, and he's using this metaphor about aliens and demon spirits, really, that he's saying that we're summoning these entities by creating this artificial intelligence. And he says this is – he's using a metaphor here for aliens and, entities that are somehow extraterrestrial or extra spiritual. Anyway, this is what he's saying here. But and some of the symbolism that he's using is pretty remarkable. But this is a guy who's a major into the artificial intelligence.
That goes like this. So D-Wave builds quantum computers. The way that they work, if you know this, how this works, is one of the interpretations is that you tap into these parallel universes and they do computations. Sounds really weird. But what's happened is this idea has been hijacked to describe something called the Mandela effect, which is this thing where the past changes. So think about something you know to be true from the past. And then imagine you went out on the internet and you can't find it at all. It's not there. It doesn't match with your experience. So these people think that D-Wave is responsible and CERN. And, of course, the quantum key to the abyss factors into it somehow. I'm not exactly sure how. So that's just D-Wave. I did that for about 15 years. It was a lot of fun. A big science project that we turned into a commercial entity. That was a warm-up for Kindred. So Kindred is much, much, much more ambitious than D-Wave. And what Kindred is trying to do is build real AI. So what you've heard about AI is not what we mean by AI. What we mean by AI is a software system that can do literally anything that a human can do. Literally anything. And obviously, computers are better at things than people in lots of different ways. So now imagine, not only can they do everything that a human can do, but they can do everything that the best human at any task could do better than them. So imagine there was the mental Olympics of the 100-meter dash, and Usain Bolt is the fastest person. Now imagine that's some kind of a mental thing, like writing a novel or writing whatever. Imagine now that the thing is so much faster than Usain Bolt, like, for example, it's a spaceship, yeah? It's still doing the same thing, but it's doing it so much better because we're limited, because we're people. So what Kindred is trying to do is solve this problem. How do you build machines that are better than people at everything? Now, there's a mental block that we have here when we think about this. Because when you think about that, one of your questions might be, for example, what are the applications of this? So imagine this. Imagine for $10, let's say, I could build a machine, like a little robot that had fingers and eyes and all that, and it could do your job better than you, no matter what it is, and I could sell that to your employer for, say, $15 and make a profit instead of having to pay you $100,000 a year. Now, imagine that was true for every single job. So that's what we're talking about here, is a complete and utter transformative change that of the likes of which has never been seen before in the history of humanity, making the Industrial Revolution look like a little tiny blip on the path that humans have taken from when we emerged from the ooze a few billion years ago.
I think this guy's still in the ooze.
We are right on the verge of that transition now. So this guy, Rich Sutton, is one of the most famous people in the academic world of AI. And like many, when asked, when will this happen, he says things like this. 25% chance within 13 years of this thing that I'm talking about.
There's a 13 again.
You know, when you think about what you read on the news, you know, CNN, BuzzFeed, whatever, they're all kind of the same nowadays. Think about how unimportant that thing is that you're reading if this is true. So what does this have to do with aliens? So Sam Harris, who I quite admire, is a very interesting guy, was reciting this parable at a TED Talk that he was giving, and it goes something like this. I'm the President of the United States. So I receive this message from the heavens. So my microwave dish, my SETI dish, finally captures something. And what it says is, in 50 years, or 13 years, we're coming to your planet. You got to be ready.
Now, this is a metaphor, ladies and gentlemen. I want to remind you again, if you're just tuning in, he's talking about aliens, but the aliens are a metaphor for the technology that he says is coming.
Now, just imagine what would happen if that happened. A super intelligent alien race beamed down a message to all of us Earthlings saying, we're coming July 13th, 2030, and boy, you better be ready because the mothership is landing right on the front lawn of the White House or wherever you wanted to land on that day. the amount of resources that would be marshaled to try to figure out what to do would encompass the whole world. AI is just like that. So when this thing that I'm talking about happens, it's going to be exactly the thing that you're thinking about those super intelligent AIs. So the one thing I can tell you is they're not going to be like us. So alien means, you know, different. These things that we're building are not going to be people. They might be really smart. They might be really good at all sorts of different things, but they're not going to be like us. They're going to be aliens. And they're going to be, I'm sorry to say, way smarter than every single person in this room in ways that we can't even comprehend. So this, of course, triggers a lot of alarm. One of the guys who talks about this is Elon, who says things like this, like, when you do this, beware. Because you think, just like the guy in the stories, that when you do this, you're going to put that little guy in a pentagram, and you're going to have your holy water out, and you're going to wave it at the thing, and by God, it's going to do exactly what you say, and not one thing more, but it never works out that way. So this is an attitude that some are having, this emerging alarmism about the way this is going to go. But these words, demons, doesn't capture the essence of what's happening here. I don't know if any of you are turn-of-the-century weird fiction fans, but there's this guy named H.P. Lovecraft.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I got to take the break. There's just a little bit more left of this. It's pretty bizarre, but let's take the top of the hour break, and we'll continue on. This is Govern America. Time's going by very quickly. We'll be back in a moment after the top of the hour jump.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Studies have shown that the farm soil we get our vegetables from is dead, meaning it is depleted of minerals. Sulfur is a mineral. Sulfur has been depleted from the soil, which means most people have been depleted of sulfur. Sulfur has been found to transport oxygen throughout the body. You need oxygen. You need organic sulfur. American Voice Radio Network has organic sulfur. Go to AmericanVoiceRadio.com and then to the Superstore to order your organic sulfur. It's your choice. Do you want to feel better or not? Don't forget to tune in to the Sulfur Hour Plus One on AmericanVoiceRadio.com Thursdays, 6 p.m. Pacific.
Crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America.
Die,
govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is the second hour of Govern America. Darren Weeks, Vicki Davis here with you. As we are every Saturday, we have John in Tennessee on the line. It continues to be the 16th of December 2017 as we get right back into it here, talking about the quantum computers and the artificial intelligence and all that it entails, and the bizarreness of some of these people that are pushing these programs. It's very, very strange. Very strange indeed. I don't know if you have any thoughts about what you've heard so far, Vicki.
As a matter of fact, I wrote something in 2010 that was very much like what he was saying. I said, doing the kind of research I do is like watching a disaster movie in slow motion. The disaster isn't a plane crash or an earthquake. This is more like being on a different planet, the planet Cryptovik. And with my telescopic vision, I'm able to see that the Earth has been taken over by monsters who look human but who lack humanity. Okay, now what this guy is talking about are expert systems. And the problem is that with expert systems, it's like a logic tree. You know, true, false. You know, question, true, false. And you walk through the logic tree. If what you're doing is procedural, they work reasonably well, but it is absolute, just straight logic that a programmer writes.
Yeah.
Okay, so if he leaves something out, your decision tree, your expert system doesn't work.
Or it works incorrectly.
We need to be, Vicki, we need to be more concerned with what he's bringing in, because if Darren continues to play that clip, and I'm not disagreeing with you to disagree with you, but he's not talking about a logic tree. Darren, you need to continue that clip.
No, he's talking about expert systems. And what I said is that
he's talking about entities, Vicki.
Well, yeah, he's but I think the entities are a metaphor.
It's a metaphor. He's talking about a logical construction of a human thinking, of a human being thinking and making decisions.
I don't doubt that
Darren, play it and then let her see that.
All right. Well, I interpret it
this.
Okay. Let's we'll hear the rest of it. There's not that much more left of it.
I don't know if any of you are turn of the century weird fiction fans, but there's this guy named H.P. Lovecraft, who's a very famous American weird fiction author, and he espoused a view which is called cosmicism, and the essence of cosmicism is cosmic indifference. So what he was saying is basically, yes, there are these massively intelligent entities out there, but they're not good, they're not evil, they just don't give a shit about you even in the slightest. The same way that you don't care about an ant is the same way they're not going to care about you. And these things that we're summoning into the world now are not demons, they're not evil, but they're more like the Lovecraftian great old ones. There are entities that are not necessarily going to be aligned with what we want. So this transition is really, really massively important for our entire species to navigate. And going back to that thing that Sam Harris was saying, nobody is paying attention. This thing is happening in the background while people bicker about politics and what's going to be in the healthcare plan in the U.S. And underneath it all is this rising tsunami that, if we're not careful, is going to wipe us all out. On that pleasant note, we're hiring people to try to make something like this happen.
It's going to wipe us all out. And, oh, by the way, we want to make this happen. We want everybody to be wiped out.
We're not trying to prevent it. Vicki, it's pretty clear that they're summoning entities.
Well, I still interpret it as a metaphor.
He's using a metaphor. I know exactly the kind of programming that he's talking about. And what he is doing is he is defining a program as an entity. And an example that I can give you is what I know that they are doing with the healthcare field. They are converting our healthcare system to be based on chemistry, based on DNA. And theoretically, the computer can analyze the tests that they've done on you, and they can spit out a prescription to that is supposed to cure you or contain the disease, whatever it is. But the program is the one that makes a decision on what your treatment is going to be. And so he's kind of anthropomorphizing, in a way, making a computer, defining a computer program to be an entity, because that entity is supposed to replace the expert.
Well, what
the healthcare field to replace the doctor.
Yeah, and what I look at it, I interpret it the same way you do, Vicky. I mean, what's weird about it is the fact that he would use that particular metaphor. We're summoning demons. We're summoning evil spirits, or we're summoning aliens from outer space. What he's talking about here is this.
With him.
Well, the spirit of the artificial intelligence. He's talking about how these things that they are summoning, in other words, they're building AI systems that have the potential of completely wiping out humanity, completely taking control, and you think you're going to have your little pentagram and you know, your holy water and control these things are going to completely run roughshod over everybody else.
Right, so, and I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, I totally agree that an evil is being imposed on humanity, and the evil is a program that functions on absolute logic with no mechanism to correct it.
Yeah.
Okay, and if you look at life in an absolute logical fashion, a lot of people are going to die because it doesn't make logical sense to keep them alive. You know, if you look at calculating the value of a human being in terms of their contribution to society, there are a lot of people that don't really contribute in a monetary sense.
Yeah.
And they will die under a program that operates strictly on cold-blooded logic, and that is an evil. It is like the ultimate evil.
Yeah, I mean, it's really ironic, and John dropped, but it's really ironic that we have the social, you know, that this guy would rely upon some kind of a metaphor like that in the first place. I don't doubt that a lot of these people involved in this are themselves in their personal life tapping into dark energy. I mean, I think all of this is driven by Satan, to be honest with you.
For him
to think of a metaphor like that, I don't doubt for a second that he's involved in probably a cult and, you know, all kinds of underworld activity.
No, I don't think so. Programmers use metaphors like that because it's a way to explain something to people in terms that they can understand.
Yeah. Well,
you know, if you hadn't played that tape and if we hadn't talked about it, I could have explained expert systems to you, but you wouldn't really have grasped the magnitude of what it means.
Yeah.
And so.
Well.
So they use metaphors. I use metaphors to explain it to people so that they can feel it, so they can see it, so they can integrate it into their thinking, you know, because a lot of times people will hear things and it's like it goes in one ear and out the other.
Well, I don't.
It doesn't register in the brain.
I look at it from the standpoint, Vicky. This stuff is evil. And I do believe it's driven by a spiritual nature, and it's just my opinion, but I think that everything that happens in this world is a manifestation of something that happens, on a spiritual plane. But that's just my opinion. Anyway, moving along.
Engineers have a way of separating their thinking into, the mathematical and the logical is over here, and leaving out the human side of it over here.
Yeah.
So that you have a division in your thinking. So they can do their system engineering, which is what they're talking about, without integrating their own personal feelings into it, because it's just a job. They're building a program.
If anyone thinks that these
paid for it.
These systems can be benevolent,
no,
I think
they can't.
The end result. They talk about artificial intelligence, and this guy alluded to it himself, that we, and he didn't say this, but I'm paraphrasing here, I think this is kind of what he was getting at, is that we have to be on watch that all of this stuff could wipe people out. But then he makes his pitch for, because we're hiring, and, we want to make this happen. Well, if you think that something's going to wipe out humanity, why would you want to make it happen? Why wouldn't you want to fight against it? And the problem, the fallacy here, I think, is that whoever controls the system, and there are people that are going to control the system, whoever controls the system inevitably are the ones that are going to have the power. To suggest that all of these things are going to be, autonomous, self-governing, I think is foolhardy, at least at this point in time.
And that's the problem of living in a commercial state, isn't it? Because he's getting paid a lot of money to do what he's doing, and he's living pretty comfortably, and to hell with the future.
Yeah.
Hell with anybody who is going to be wiped out with this. He and his family will know about these systems and may be able to escape or circumvent the logic.
Yeah, well, and he does make that pitch to the people that are there that if you want to have a say in all of this, come work for me because your code will determine how these things think.
But that's delusional. That's completely delusional.
Well, it's aspirations of a dictator.
Logic is true or false. The question and the answer is true or false. It's logic. It's pure logic. That's it.
Yeah. Well, getting to the, we were talking about the social engineering earlier, and one of the things that has kind of become a theme on the program here is how society is being engineered, how damaging these social networks are basically short-circuiting people's brains and making them to the point where society can't function. We referenced the professional cuddlers, the detrimental society of that. Those are springing up at various locations now. We even have the, former developers of some of the social media companies are beginning to speak out against these tools that they help create. There are two that have come out just, within the last few weeks talking against Facebook. The most recent is a guy by the name of Shamath Palihapitiya, I think. I'm sure I butchered the last name. He helped design Facebook, and that's something for which he now feels a tremendous amount of guilt. And he's saying now he's urging people to abandon Facebook because he says you're being programmed.
I want to bring us back to the point that you were making about exploiting consumer behavior in a consumer internet business. You said that this is a time for soul searching in social media businesses, and you were part of building the largest one. What soul searching are you doing right now on that?
I feel tremendous guilt. I think we all knew in the back of our minds even though we feigned this whole line of like there probably aren't any really bad unintended consequences, I think in the back, deep, deep recesses of our minds, we kind of knew something bad could happen. But I think the way we defined it was not like this. It literally is a point now where I think we have created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works. That is truly where we are. And I would encourage all of you as the future leaders of the world to really internalize how important this is. If you feed the beast, that beast will destroy you. If you push back on it, we have a chance to control it and rein it in. And it is a point in time where people need to hard break from some of these tools and the things that you rely on. The short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created are destroying how society works. No civil discourse, no cooperation, misinformation, mistruth. And it's not an American problem. This is not about Russian ads. This is a global problem. So we are in a really bad state of affairs right now, in my opinion. It is eroding the core foundations of how people behave by and between each other. And I don't have a good solution. You know, my solution is I just don't use these tools anymore. I haven't for years. It's created huge tension with my friends, huge tensions in my social circles. If you look at, like, you know, my Facebook feed, I've posted maybe 2 times in 7 years. 3 times, 5 times. It's less than 10. And it's weird. I guess I kind of just innately didn't want to get programmed. And so I just tuned it out. But I didn't confront it. And now to see what's happening, it really bums me out. Like, think about, like, there were these examples where there was a hoax in WhatsApp where in some, like, village in India, people were, like, afraid that their kids were going to get kidnapped, etc. And then there were these lynchings that happened as a result where people were, like, vigilante running around. They think they found the person and they... I mean, seriously? Like, that's what we're dealing with. You know, imagine, like, when you take that to the extreme, where, you know, bad actors can now manipulate large swaths of people to do anything you want. It's just it's a really, really bad state of affairs. And we compound the problem, right? We curate our lives around this perceived sense of perfection, because we get rewarded in these short-term signals, hearts, likes, thumbs up, and we conflate that with value and we conflate it with truth. And instead, what it really is fake, brittle popularity that's short-term and that leaves you even more, and admit it, vacant and empty before you did it. Because then it forces you into this vicious cycle where you're like, what's the next thing I need to do now?
Hire professional cuddlers.
Because I need it back. Think about that compounded by 2 billion people. And then think about how people react then to the perceptions of others. It's really bad. It's really, really bad.
It sounds like you're taking deep personal responsibility also in being a part of it.
I did a great job there. And I think that business overwhelmingly does positive good in the world. Where I have decided to spend my time is to take the capital that they rewarded me with and now focus on the structural changes that I can control. I can't control that. I can control my decisions, which is I don't use this shit. I can control my kids' decisions, which is they're not allowed to use this shit. And then I can go focus on diabetes and education and climate change. And that's what I can do. But everybody else has to soul search a little bit more about what you're willing to do, because your behaviors, you don't realize it, but you are being programmed. It was unintentional, but now you got to decide how much you're willing to give up, how much of your intellectual independence. And don't think, oh yeah, not me, I'm a genius, I'm at Stanford. You're probably the most likely to fall for it. Because you were checkboxing your whole damn life. No offense, guys.
What do you think of that?
I agree with him, of course, you know, about Facebook, and I have I do know that people are addicted to it. I'm addicted to the internet, not Facebook, but to doing research and writing.
Well, he's talking about the dopamine cycles where people, and I've seen this myself, the constant need for validation, the constant need for a thumbs up, the constant need for somebody somewhere, no matter who it is, to validate you by giving you a like or giving you some type of promotion. No, this is what he's talking about here. This is you're being programmed. You got to have this constant dopamine, this shot of dopamine, to validate you, and it's destroying things. And I think this is where I was talking about a few weeks ago with this professional cuddler thing now, and all of this stuff with this feelings and Care Bears and everybody's got to be coddled. This is what we're getting at here. Young people taking selfies constantly because they're seeking attention. They're seeking the need to be told how beautiful they are, how wonderful they are. And so any negativity whatsoever, they just shut down. They just can't handle it. They just go berserk.
Yeah. I don't even know what to say about it because it's so...
We're at a crossroads here.
I don't know. Maybe older people don't need as much validation. I know younger people do.
No, older people have grown up with the need to be able to function independent. Society prepared people at one time to deal with situations. Society prepared people to think independently. All of that is going out the window now. Now it's groupthink. Now it's let's dialogue to consensus and the consensus rules.
Well, and that's what they're teaching them in school.
Exactly.
You know, and going back to the commercial state, it was corporations that, and Microsoft being one of them, and IBM that defined the way that the schools would function. And they designed a system that was essentially like, you know, bringing a trainee into a corporation for their first job, except that they defined 12 years of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so our young people will be graduating from school not knowing anything. I saw one exercise that I watched, I think I mentioned it on a program before, where it was a school exercise where they were doing some kind of project management function or time management scheduling or, you know, something like that, something that you would learn on the job after you already got a job. You know, when I first started working, and, you know, where they might send you to a seminar, you know, for a couple of hours to learn how to do something. But this was like a full class session in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Totally useless information for a high school student.
Yeah. Well,
so,
it's not a good scene where we're headed with all of this stuff. And we also talked about the phenomenon called Pokemon Go. You know, that was a phenomenon that was huge a few years ago. I don't know how huge it is now. I'm assuming it probably is still going on. But people were running around in the middle of the night, chasing little imaginary cartoon figures on the streets, you know, that don't exist, but in their phones. And there was a follow-up story that Ron had sent me regarding this. And this just goes to show you, Nancy and I, at the time she was co-hosting, we were talking about how crazy this thing is.
Remember that Pokemon craze? Well, it seems it was quite costly. A new study at Purdue University estimates that Pokemon Go players across the country caused anywhere between $2 and $7 billion in damages, with car crashes, injuries, and deaths last year. In the game, players are encouraged to roam by foot to find digital creatures that can add to their collections. The more they walk, the more they can catch. Well, many players, however, jumped into cars to take their games on the road in hopes of increasing their odds of catching a rare Pokemon.
That's what it's come to.
Oh my God.
This is what it's come to.
I didn't know what all that Pokemon stuff was about. I mean, I knew it was a craze, but I didn't realize that's what they were doing.
It's virtual reality. And
yeah.
We're increasingly, people are living in a virtual reality world. I guess they can't handle present-day reality, so it's a matter of let's see what we can do and pretend. Let's just live a pretend life. It's unbelievable.
Well, and that goes back to what that guy that committed suicide. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're living in a world that makes no sense at all, it's very difficult to deal with, you know, it's like watching society die is what it is.
It's your description of a car crash in slow motion or something like that.
Kind
of big destruction in slow motion is a really good analogy. Mm-hmm. It's a really good analogy. While we're on the subject of the youth, I got one more thing here. This is a follow-up in the case where, you remember some months ago, we were talking, I think it was last year, actually, we played audio from the young people who are supposedly taking it upon themselves to sue the federal government over climate change. You remember that? And of course,
no, I don't, but go ahead.
Yeah, we played the audio from some of the people and of course, some of the groups that were, you know, including the attorney, who were pushing this thing. And of course, it has nothing to do with the children. The children are just pawns. They're being exploited. They're being sucked in. And wow, we're already at the bottom of the hour again. But this now a federal court is hearing oral arguments in the climate change lawsuit. These 21 young people, you know, Agenda 21, 21 young people. Nice touch, huh?
Yeah, I do vaguely recall it now that you mention it. Yes, I do.
Yeah. So now it says, Seeker says, a bold climate change lawsuit faces a pivotal test this week as a federal court considers whether young people can sue the U.S. government for failing to protect the environment. The lawsuit is Juliana versus the United States, and they say it's attracted a growing interest in the legal world for its unique and unprecedented approach to climate change. So that's something to keep an eye on. It should be thrown completely out of court because it's so absurd. But folks, we're living in the day of the absurd. So who knows what's going to happen with this. Tell you what, bottom of the hour, let's take the break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America.
Dr. Shami, I come seeking your wisdom.
My wisdom is this. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you are sincere in your belief.
Oh, you are so wise.
Yes. Now, why are you carrying a 2x4?
Oh, I'm a member of the religious wood bonkers, and we believe that if you hit a person on the side of the head with this holy 2x4, they will feel nothing but pleasure and go immediately to heaven.
You believe that?
You said believing is all that matters.
Yes, I did say that.
In fact, let me send you to heaven.
Hold on.
You're not supposed to duck.
Wait a minute. There are physical laws.
Quit ducking.
And one of those laws is that if you hit a person on the head with a 2x4, they will experience a lot of pain.
Wait. If there are physical laws to obey, then there must be spiritual laws to obey.
Now, I didn't say that.
Which means I may have to be concerned about truth. I may even have to examine if Jesus was who he claimed to be, which means reading the Bible.
Well, now, let's not get rash.
Another message from Lifeline Productions, the comic strip of radio, at lifelinepro.com.
With Govern America News this hour, I'm Darren Weeks. Congress is set to give the gift that keeps on spying. Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is set to expire at the end of 2017. The FISA law is the basis for two mass surveillance programs administered by the National Security Agency. PRISM lets the NSA access emails, video chats, instant messages, and other content sent via Facebook, Google, Apple, and other services. Upstream lets the NSA worm its way into internet backbone cables and switches to scan traffic for communications of tens of thousands of targeted individuals. The program has been highly controversial since the Snowden revelations, as it was never supposed to be used as a dragnet to spy on ordinary Americans without a warrant. For months, the Trump administration has been actively lobbying Congress to reauthorize Section 702 in its entirety. Now, according to The Intercept, Trump is actively considering a proposal to establish his own global private spy network that would circumvent official U.S. intelligence agencies and answer directly to the White House. According to the Washington Post, there are more than a dozen black budget national intelligence agencies already receiving more than $52.6 billion in secret government funding. Among the top five black ops agencies currently are the CIA, the NSA, the National Reconnaissance Office, the National Geospatial Intelligence Program, and the General Defense Intelligence Program. If Trump's plan is approved, this one would be yet another secret government agency carrying out secret surveillance and counterintelligence funded by a secret black ops budget that by its very nature does away with transparency, bypasses accountability, and completely eludes any form of constitutionality. That's the news this hour. I'm Darren Weeks.
Did you hear?
What?
There was another burglary last night, just down the street, and the family was home sleeping.
Scary. You ever thought about buying a gun?
Yeah, but I worry about my kids. You hear about all these gun accidents.
Accidents do happen, it's true. But the fact is, less than 200 children die in gun accidents every year. Far more children accidentally drown or get killed riding bikes. And thousands of children die in car accidents every year.
Ooh, talk about scary.
And according to the statistics, people who own guns, parents like you and me, prevent over 1 million violent crimes every year and save countless lives.
Wow. Do you own a gun?
Yeah, I do.
Get the facts on gun control. Visit armedandsecure.org. That's armedandsecure.org.
Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. Our website is governamerica.com. That's the website for the broadcast here. Governamerica.com, and Vicky's websites are thetechnocratictyranny.com, thetechnocratictyranny.com, and channelingreality.com. You need to check those information, that information out. She wrote an article on the rise of the Socialist International. You've got to read that, folks. I tweeted it out on Twitter. You've got to make sure you read that because that's very, very important. Anyway, moving along here, by the way, the Republicans have got their combined tax bill now. Congress, the both houses of Congress put the two bills they had together. Thankfully, it's not quite as bad as the original bill. They restored some of the state deductions and everything. If they really wanted to do something for the country, they'd eliminate this income tax thing altogether. But, of course, that's not going to happen. At least it's not as bad as we originally talked about, at least according to what, and I haven't read the bill. I think the bill is like 500 pages. And just reading about the bill, it looks like they've made some improvements to it for whatever that's worth. And there you have it. Of course,
I don't trust them when they major rewrites of anything.
Well, and another thing that I was just about to say is you never know what's hidden in something in these massive mega bills. There's a lot of pork that they add to it to get support of certain people and certain other representatives on board and that sort of thing. So it's a dirty, filthy, disgusting business. And the problem is, no matter what bill it is, anytime they do tax reform, it's all about raising more money. It's all about raising more money for the federal government, taking more of what you own, because government will never control its spending. And this is the real issue here. They're never going to actually scale down anything that they're doing. And we spend more money than, I think, on our military than any other nation combined. I think I can say that.
Well, and if you add in the civilian funding for technology that serves dual purpose, that is dual purpose, civilian and military, you can add more billions to defense spending. but it's put under civilian budgets.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
So, yeah, they always raise tax. You know, I don't care what they say about lowering taxes on the people. It'll be like Obamacare, you know. It'll benefit a few people, but it's going to hurt a lot more people than it benefits.
Right. Exactly. And so I won't go through the salient points on this. There are more tax brackets than there were before. But for those that are interested, I'll put a couple of links in the show notes, and you can read about it. And, you know, one thing that we do need to talk about is this Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act. I know you wrote a piece about this called Guns, Dialectics, and Computer Systems, which I reposted on Govern America's site because it's very important. I look at this, Vicki, as a backdoor gun control bill. Because the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to override state law, and it is supposed to make it legal for people to carry concealed in any state, including states that don't have, you know, favorable laws on the books for that. Well, there's two things wrong with that. Number one, state law trumps federal law, and I don't care what anyone tries to tell you, that's just the reality of it. And if you go into a state which doesn't have the law on the books, which makes it illegal for you to carry concealed, they're going to arrest you. And where's the federal government? Where are they going to come in to help you? I mean, there's nobody at the Justice Department that's going to come to your defense. You think Trump's going to issue you a presidential pardon every time for everyone that happens to? Of course not. So there's that problem. So the law, it's in and of itself, and I can see why Second Amendment proponents would support such a law, but that's the sales pitch. That's to get you on board to support it, because it gives you this carrot that you think it's going to do something favorable for gun rights, when in reality it really has no effect. That's point number one. Point number two is, and this is really the dangerous part about it, is it really amounts to backdoor gun control, in my opinion, because it makes it harder for people to get guns. And already there have been stories of the feds going around talking, you know, collecting guns that have already, for permits that have already been issued. And this is the thing that really worries me. When I read that, I thought, holy mackerel, we're in a situation already where gun confiscation is already taking place in America. They're saying that they issued the federal, the background check system issued guns that shouldn't have been issued, and now we got to get those guns back off the streets. So they're going around now and collecting guns from people that they've already, for whom they've already issued permits. Ladies and gentlemen, this, in my opinion, is how it starts. This is very alarming to me.
You really can't trust their computer systems, because the people that are designing and writing those systems are the Marxist left.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when they wrote the system to, what was it, the E-Verify system, that supposedly was to check and see whether a person was legally, a foreigner was legally in the country. Well, that was a registration system simply by the virtue of doing the check. They were approved unless they had a criminal history, but even then, you know, some of them were approved apparently. So Their systems don't necessarily do what you're told that they do.
Right. Well, and I look at it from the standpoint, if they can go around and collect guns for permits they've already issued and say, we incorrectly issued those permits, I can see them making the same argument for every other permit that they issued.
Well, did you notice in there about the domestic violence? You see, what they did with that legislation was to include domestic violence as an inhibitor for having a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, a domestic violence doesn't necessarily mean that there was any violence. It could be just, you know, the wife is angry at the husband and, you know, But you know, maybe there were no blows, but just two angry people. But it goes down on the record as domestic violence. And the guy no longer can own a gun. That's
yeah,
it.
Exactly. I'll tell you what,
you know, it's yet another wedge between the relationship of men and women. You know,
mm-hmm.
Now, if a guy actually beats up a woman, then I'm absolutely think that he should be put in jail.
Yes, I agree. But we don't want to ban. And the other thing I think we have to get away from is this notion that once you've served your time, you still have to be, you know, have this scarlet thread hanging over your head the rest of your life. You're not able to ever own firearms again.
Yes,
my problem,
because he might be a hunter. What if he's a hunter?
Well, what if he was
never go?
What if he was a part of a gang before he went in there, and not, you know, and he went in there and he rolled over on his fellow gang members to take down that you know, as a condition of having a reduced sentence. Then he comes out. Now he's a sitting duck. He's not allowed to own firearms legally, and so he's putting himself in jeopardy if he does, if he can get them. But at the same time, he's a sitting duck because now he's a target. I mean, this is the problem with the whole system. If you're not a threat to society, to be out and about among the average, everyday, you know, everybody else, then you should be restored and made whole. All of your rights should not be conditioned based upon your past. At some point, you are redeemed. At some point, you're made whole. But that's not the way they're doing it today. And the problem with this is it creates a multi-tiered class society where some people enjoy the constitutional rights, supposed constitutional rights, and other people don't. That's a big issue.
Right. Well, besides, if whatever you did didn't involve the use of a gun, then they have no business including the gun in there.
Exactly.
Because anybody can lose their temper at any time. But, you know, if unless you pull a gun on somebody, just the mere fact of having a gun doesn't mean you'll ever use it. You know?
Well, I would go so far as to say that even if it did involve a gun, again, if you are released from prison, if you've done your time, and they determine that you're no longer a threat to society based upon the fact that they release you from prison, then you should be made whole. And they're not doing that today. And that's the dangerous thing about it. Got a call on the line. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Sam calling.
Hey, how you doing?
Couldn't agree with you guys more on all this stuff. I'll just throw one other caveat into it. It's a minor caveat, but you guys, I couldn't agree more on every point you've made so far. The other part is, always remember, it's a Republican administration now. If the Dems get back in and want to reverse everything, then who's going to be crying to get their states out of it? In other words, isn't it interesting how nullification and state nullification works fine for a certain group going one way, but not the other way?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, you're right about that.
Well, at this point, I'm at the point where I really see very little difference between any party. So Republicans, Dems, I'm sure that the Democrats are going to get in there very, very soon, because people are very... I think many of the Republicans have lost their base because you've seen what they've done after they get in there. They're not following through on their word. This tax increase, it's a miracle. I say tax increase because some of the percentages have gone down, but they tried to eliminate state deductions. And in some cases, the state deductions are still gone. Now, they restored student loan interest deductions. They've restored property tax deductions. I'm not sure all of the deductions that they have. I think income tax is up to State income tax is deductible up to $10,000, I believe, if I remember correctly. So there's some things that they've done to try to placate, you know, but the only reason they've done that is because Republican senators and representatives in the high tax states were complaining about it. They were worried about getting reelected. So, you know, we've heard for years about tax and spend Democrats. I think the tax and spend Republicans are just right there on par with them. I see no difference, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just simply say that, you know, and again, now here again, I can't prove this, but I'm just going to say, you know, because knowing how the way the game is played, how do we know that all this reciprocity stuff wasn't put out there purposely to get all the gun people to go for it, and then after the other side gets in, they get what they wanted all the time, and that is to use the same bill in reverse to get all the guns.
Yeah, well, and I think
I'm sure it was. And I'll tell you why. The way that I found out about that piece of legislation was a guy who had been a proponent, a very active proponent of reciprocity. But when he saw the detail of what they were doing and how they were including domestic violence in there as a prohibition on gun ownership, he totally reversed his position, and he was trying to get messages out to everybody to call their representatives and say, don't support this bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because it puts the feds in charge of what is absolutely a state and local issue of domestic violence.
Absolutely. Now we've got the situation where Chicago, a gun-free zone, ladies and gentlemen, things have gotten so bad there now that there's actually one I forget it what his position is, but he's a high-ranking official. I think he's a lawmaker. I need to find the story so I get it right. But he's going to the United Nations in New York asking them to send UN troops, UN peacekeepers, into Chicago to take care of the situation. This is a gun-free zone, and he's calling for UN troops to be brought in to keep order.
Problem, reaction, solution.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's all geared towards implementing law internationally. And that's I don't know whether or not you watched Trump give his speech to the FBI, the graduating class at Quantico. But
no.
When the first speaker was speaking, he talked about how many people from foreign countries had gone through Quantico. So our FBI training academy is not only being used by Americans, you know, they're bringing in foreigners. And that's all part of the globalization of management, management of countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're implementing a global management system and a global labor force. So that, you know, theoretically, you know, a cop from the Middle East is going to function the same way that a cop in Colorado functions.
Yeah.
But we know that isn't true. You know, people react based upon their culture and their conditioning as they were growing up.
Well, more and more I see people in the law, so-called law enforcement, conditioning, you know, reacting in a way that, you know, all of them can bash in heads just equally. And that's what I see happening more and more. I found the story, by the way. Alex Newman writes in The New American, under the guise of stopping gun violence and genocide, a fringe county commissioner in Cook County, Illinois, went to New York City to request that the United Nations deploy peacekeeping troops in Chicago. This would be the same ruthless soldiers who have come under fire around the world for systematic rape of children, spreading deadly diseases, murdering unarmed protesters, overthrowing elected leaders, waging war on Africans who do not want to live under a Soviet-backed dictator, and countless other atrocities, especially atrocities targeting black people and always perpetrated with impunity. Of course, the dictator's club, known as the United Nations, has no legal power to deploy the scandal-plagued forces in America, and most Americans armed with hundreds of millions of weapons would unlikely accept such an absurdity. But the fact is that the ludicrous request would even be contemplated, particularly by an elected official, highlights a number of major problems that threaten liberty and the nation itself. So it goes on from there.
I don't really agree with him that they don't have the authority. That's the problem with our government signing so many treaties and international agreements.
Well, I don't think he has the authority because treaties don't, despite what many people try to say, treaties do not override the Constitution. And I know, you know, forgive me for keep bringing that in, but the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And that makes every single thing that they're doing extra constitutionally, it makes them, makes it illegal.
And, okay, well, on a theoretical level, mm-hmm. I agree with you. On a real time, this is the world we live in. It's the guy with the gun who's making the rules. They're not following our Constitution. None of these agreements that they signed, you know, creating the WTO, creating the international zone on the border, the NAFTA agreement, none of those things were constitutional. Every agreement that they've signed that has transferred sovereignty to international bodies has been unconstitutional.
Yeah.
But unless the Constitution is enforced, it's just like George Bush said, it's just a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And you know, we can take it to court, but, you know, the Supreme Court is useless to us because, number one, we can't afford it. Number two, there's no guarantee that they would take the case even if you were able to take it through the whole process.
Yeah.
So really, our government at this point, especially the legal system, is extraordinarily flawed. It's flawed to the point to where they're taking our country down.
Yeah, I agree. Moving along here, in the interest of time, you know, a few Agenda 21 items. We know that Oregon already has gone to, I believe it's Oregon, went to a per mile tax on travel, on car, you know, travel. Now California is
filed. Wow, they did that?
I believe so. We covered it on the show. That was back a while. I'm pretty sure that they did. I'll look it up now that you questioned me on it. But I'm pretty sure Oregon's already on board with that. But California is doing the same thing.
California is moving closer to charging drivers for every mile they drive.
Yeah, the state says it needs more money for road repairs, and the gas tax just isn't cutting it. KPIX5's Phil Mateer on Sacramento wanting to take a look at your odometer. Phil?
That's right, because it's not just an issue about money, it's also a question of fairness, because of the cars that aren't at the pump here paying the tax. Let's take a look.
One of the biggest selling points for electric cars and hybrids is that they save you big money at the pump. But at what cost to the rest of us?
If you own like an older vehicle that is fueled by gas, you're paying gas tax to maintain the roads. Someone who has an electric vehicle or a dramatically more fuel-efficient vehicle is paying much less than you are, but they're still using the roads.
And that's one of the reasons why State Senator Scott Wiener and others are saying that when it comes to road taxes, it's time to start looking at charging you by the mile.
Yeah, he's a wiener, all right.
Rather than by the gallon.
people are going to use less and less gas in the long run.
And less gas means less gas tax, and less gas tax means less money for the roads.
We want to make sure that all cars are actually paying to maintain the road.
One idea would be to install devices that could clock your mileage every time you pull up to a pump or electric car charging station, or put a tracker on every car.
The reality is that if you have a smartphone, your data of where you're traveling is already in existence.
None of this talk of a mileage fee is sitting well with Joshua Lee, owner of this little super hybrid BMW. How much are you saving by not using gas?
When using gas, I save around $200 a month.
If you buy a small car like this that gets really good fuel economy, there's no doubt that we don't get enough money to repair the local streets and roads, and there's a pothole right there. But the fact of the matter is that people are buying trucks like that vehicle there.
Randy Rentschler of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission said the real answer is to raise the gas tax even more and up the fee for electric cars while you're at it.
Just raise the registration fee on electric cars and it will solve the problem.
And what do the people we talked to tanking up today say?
Yeah, I drive all over Northern California for work, so definitely be a problem.
Like, these are all consumption taxes based for taxing poor people.
Now, Caltrans has just wrapped up a pilot program that used 5,000 drivers in the state of California to track them voluntarily. The results were positive enough to where Caltrans is now asking tech companies to come up with possibly a way to make it mass. Alan, Veronica?
Phil, assuming this mileage fee plan goes through, what's going to happen to the gas tax that, oh, by the way, just went up? We're still going to have to pay that?
Alan, they say that this is to replace the gas tax. But as you and I and everybody else on the road knows, rarely have we ever seen a tax go down, and I've never recall one going away.
There you go. And by the way, yes, I do remember talking about this on the show. The website, you might want to jot it down if you want to look at it, myorego.org. myorego.org. So Oregon's already on board with this per mile tax system, and now California is just about to follow suit. I got a feeling this is just the beginning. There'll be other states as well.
Oh, no question. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's Agenda 21.
Tech takeover of the world, really.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Agenda 21. We've been saying for years and many others that travel is limited under Agenda 21. And what way to limit anything is to make it too expensive for you to do it. All right, top of the hour. Let's take the break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America.
I'm Steven, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is president of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the enduring importance of federalism.
Many in Washington today have grown so accustomed to centralized bureaucracy that they think of federalism as old-fashioned, kind of like fife and drum music. Those who wrote the Constitution saw federalism as a vital principle of free government in a large republic. The division of power between the federal government, state governments, and local governments would serve as an important protection against tyranny. The founders also understood that while the federal government is essential for national matters like foreign policy and defense, governments closer to the people were far better suited to oversee local matters. As we see in the problems that result from centralized bureaucracy today, there's nothing out of date about the founders' argument for federalism.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Most people realize their body needs clean water to function properly. Pure is the cleanest water, also known as distilled water. Some frauds pushing fake science and ignorant people repeating their disinformation and half-truths will tell you distilled water leaches minerals from the body. What they fail to tell you is distilled water only attracts and flushes inorganic minerals from your body. These are minerals your body cannot process and can interfere with your proper body functions. Distilled water does flush these inorganic materials from your body and is an effective and natural way to cleanse your body. ABR sells a distiller that distills 1 gallon every 3.5 hours. Go to AmericanVoiceRadio.com, click on the superstore, go to the distiller, check the pricing and how to order, and watch the video explaining in detail why distilled water is pure water.
The crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is the third and final hour of Govern America. It continues to be the 16th of December, 2017, as we have Vicki Davis here. I'm Darren Weeks. Continuing on here, we've been talking in the last hour about Agenda 21 and the restrictions on travel. We also have a situation right now where there are calls now for taxes on meat consumption. Meat could join carbon and sugar to help limit emissions. This is Bloomberg. They say move over taxes on carbon and sugar. The global levy that may exist next is meat. Some investors are betting governments around the world will find a way to start taxing meat production as they aim to improve public health and hit emissions targets set in the Paris Climate Agreement. Socially focused investors are starting to push companies to diversify into plant protein or even suggest livestock producers use a shadow price of meat similar to the internal carbon price to estimate future costs. So that is the deal with taxing meat consumption. Again, the power to tax, as Thurgood Marshall said, the power to tax is the power to destroy. And
that, you know what, that's really very interesting. I watched a part of a speech given by the agricultural secretary, Perdue, and he was talking about the Soy Producers Association. I bet you that's what they're planning on doing, is putting a tax on meat and then having people get their protein from soy.
Well, I think they're planning on having people get their protein from eating synthetic meat. Because here we see from...
Isn't that what soy is? That's those soybean cakes or whatever they're called.
Yeah. Well,
I think that...
I'm not sure what they
use it as synthetic meat.
They're talking about meat growing in labs. And here we see from Wired, what's wrong with eating people?
Oh, God.
You could soon be dining on lab-grown celebrity canapés. Is it canapés? And lightly seasoned chunks of your loved ones, they say. But is the world ready for synthesized cannibalism? This is really sick. These people are really, really sick.
Well, that's absolute logic. You know, you've got all these excess people out there. Let's just eat them.
Well, I think they're talking about, I believe they're talking about synthesized, but who, you know, I don't want to eat synthesized people either.
I don't either.
That is
sick. It truly is sick and evil and just beyond It's inhuman.
Yeah, it is.
It's not human.
It's insane. What if you could tuck into a juicy human burger that was guaranteed cruelty-free? No one has to lose a shoulder for your Sunday roast. No one gets their leg sawn off for your signature slow-cook tangying. No one even has to die these days. In the not-too-distant future, we could all be tucking into lab-grown meaty cubes of our favorite celebrities or eating a synthesized slab of newlyweds to mark the special day. Wow. Here's to the future,
maybe
Vicky.
John is right. You know, maybe those people just purely are evil.
Yeah.
You know, who would ever even think of such a thing?
Yeah. Well, it's being thought of. One other thing that I wanted to talk about, and then I want to get to this NAFTA stuff. This is, and this kind of dovetails pretty well with the NAFTA stuff, actually. We talked about this, too, the transportation fiasco, which is looming for long-distance cattle haulers. But not just it's truck drivers everywhere. The Drovers.com reports transportation cattle could become much more difficult if a set of congressionally mandated trucking rules go into effect before the end of the year. The regulations have the potential to cause devastating disruptions in how cattle are hauled, creating unintended biosecurity hazards and animal welfare issues. On December 18th, which is just a few days, 2 days away, as we're doing the show, the Federal Electronic Logging Device, or ELD, rule regulated by the U.S. Department of Transportation will begin for commercial motor vehicles. ELDs are a record-keeping device synchronized to a truck engine that logs information digitally in real time, and ELD records data such as time spent on the road, miles driven, location, and engine hours. So basically, we talked about this before. This is the logging thing, which I think is a part of T21, if I remember correctly. But it's going to be your rig will be reporting home directly to the Big Brother federal database about exactly what you do. And I maintain once they get this in place for the big rigs, eventually this is going to spread to the automobiles, you know, because everything's commercial these days, even if it's not.
Right. Well, you know, I wonder if the trucks coming in from Mexico will have those devices. I'm betting not.
Well, not if they revoke NAFTA, because this is exactly what they are working to do. And I think this is where we should probably head next. You know, we've expressed our concerns here, and of course our belief that the NAFTA renegotiation was a pre-planned tweak of the document. I know that there have been, in recent days, articles that have been put out. For instance, this one by Politico. Trump's NAFTA changes aren't much different from Obama's. We talked about how Carla Hills is on record in the past as saying that NAFTA needs to be updated because it's been 20 years since the original NAFTA document was put out, and technology has gone to the point where, I mean, you recall, the internet wasn't around really for the average person back when NAFTA was signed. And so
right.
a lot has happened technologically since that time, and so they wanted an update anyway. Here we see for The Nation, the Trump's renegotiation of NAFTA is starting to look a lot like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, as soon as Trump got into office, we talked about this, how he killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we warned people, Vicky, if you recall, you and I warned people that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be back under a different name. And here it is. They've already started rolling parts of the TPP into the new NAFTA document, but the negotiations haven't been going very well in recent days. Anyway, I want to bring in Lori Wallach. Lori Wallach is of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and she's been an outspoken critic of the so-called free trade, you know, everything, you know, all these free trade agreements. We played audio from her before when she was talking about the TPP. I believe she's a leftist. In fact, it is the leftists that are often speaking out against these bad trade agreements. Wallach spoke a while back at a forum on renegotiating NAFTA when Trump killed the TPP. Again, we told you to be back. Here it is. Let's hear what she has to say here.
So the North American Free Trade Agreement was a radical experiment. It was unlike any past trade agreement. Instead of focusing on trade, it set up all kinds of new corporate rights and powers. And it used the brand Free Trade Agreement. But at its heart are great corporate rights, investor rights, that literally elevate individual companies to the level of a nation state. As well, there are rules that incentivize job offshoring. Everyone wonders how we lost a million jobs to NAFTA. It wasn't an act of God. There are rules in the text of the NAFTA that subsidize offshoring. And that was the model that NAFTA, but even more fierce, for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, an agreement that was stopped after 7 years of international progressive civil society campaigning, that literally stopped United Corporate Power. People Power won. But with the TPP, with the NAFTA fight, we risk having TPP 2.0. Mexico and Canada were in the TPP. There's a wing of the Trump administration, and there are a lot of corporate guys who see the NAFTA as a way to revive the dead TPP and set it loose on working people and the environment.
So we have this from Foreign Policy. Even free traders think NAFTA needs an update. The trade deal is an old house that needs some work done, says one of the architects, and the architect is Carla Hills. She was Bush's former, U.S. trade representative for the...
She's the one that originally negotiated it.
Exactly. Exactly. And she said that it needs work. It needs to be updated. So my question is, was Trump brought in to hammer this issue for the purpose of doing exactly what they wanted to have done, in the first place? Now, that's a conspiratorial thought. But conspiracies happen every day, listeners.
I could be convinced that that's true, because there's been so many of his appointments that are part of the corporatocracy that's taking over.
Mm-hmm.
One of those is a guy named Azar, A-Z-A-R. He was the CEO of Eli Lilly. And Eli Lilly was one of the pharmaceutical corporations that was involved in the TMAP project in Texas,
mm-hmm.
where they were using children and Medicaid patients, to develop a expert system, just like we talked about, medicine by chemistry. And Mike Pence is also from Indiana, and Indiana is the location of the headquarters of Eli Lilly.
Yep.
So yeah, I could be convinced, and I think they had a really good team of marketing people for Trump.
Yeah.
So that he said exactly what he was supposed to say to make us
garner
all think
support.
That he was on our side.
Right.
When really he had a corporate agenda that, it, according to my research, picked up exactly where George W. Bush, his administration, left off.
I agree, and there's and Obama too, because really there's continuity of abuse. And in fact, as we get deeper into this NAFTA hearing. That we're going to be hearing from Carla Hills in a moment, but it's very apparent. One of the people said in there is that there were things that were done for integration purposes that were done beneath the radar that didn't get a whole lot of attention, and that was during the Obama administration. So it literally is continuity of abuse. But
right.
We see from the Electronic Frontier Foundation a few months ago, they said, as first NAFTA round opens in secrecy, digital rights groups fear another TPP. So there's that. They issued another one about the shrinking transparency in the NAFTA and RCEP negotiations. And that's another thing that we really haven't talked a whole lot about. There's another completely separate agreement that is being worked on right now, which is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. And this looks to me like a good, like a replacement, like an alternative. As a matter of fact, I think they even say that in the Wikipedia page for this. The regional...
Say it again.
It's RCEP, a Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. It's a proposed free trade agreement between the 10 member states of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. That's Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, and Thailand and Vietnam. Many of these nations were TPP countries. And there's also six states with which the Asian, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, what they call ASEAN for the acronym, has existed free trade agreements, existing free trade agreements. And that is Australia, China, India, Japan, South Korea, and New Zealand. RCEP negotiations, Wikipedia says, were formally launched in November 2012. So they've been working on this under the radar for many years at the Asian Summit in Cambodia. The free trade agreement is scheduled and expected to be signed next year in November during the Asian Summit and related summit in Singapore. And after the first RCEP summit was held on the 14th of November 2017. In Manila, Philippines. This is actively being worked at, and they say that it's viewed as an alternative to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Trump just killed. So nobody's talking about this.
I don't think it's an alternative. I think it's a preliminary step. They're dividing the world up into management units.
Mm-hmm.
These economic regions are are management units. You know,
well, and what it looks like to me is that they're going to piecemeal all of the components, all the pieces in, and it doesn't matter. You know, everybody was against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so for political reasons, they killed it. We'll give you what you want. Here you go. It's dead, but it's not really dead. It continues to go on, and they'll incorporate it into NAFTA. They'll incorporate it into this RCEP agreement or whatever. You know, in fact, one of the things they say in here is that this is the TPP. They looked at the NAFTA renegotiation as a way of getting the TPP, you know, getting the document updated. In other words, the TPP was viewed as a way to update NAFTA without actually having to go through the process of renegotiating NAFTA.
Yeah, oh, I believe that. Yeah, that's what I mean. They are building an international system of law. The economy of the globe, the entire global economy, is being engineered. That's why, you know, in that NAFTA hearing or panel discussion, one of them was talking about, you know, 40% of the parts come from Mexico and, you know, so many percentages of the parts come from Canada. That's because they are dividing up economic activity according to central planning of the global economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, Boeing's supply chain, you know, where Boeing has their manufacturing for airplanes distributed through a number of countries, and then they bring all the parts here and put it together. That is central planning of the global economy.
Yeah. Well, Lori Wallach talks about the loss of jobs due to NAFTA and a subject that we've talked about many times on the show before, this investor-state dispute settlement. You know, the fact that the corporations can sue governments for erecting barriers, you know, to their ability to do business, even if the barriers in the best interest of the country's general population, you know, such as environment, community health, or works, you know, OSHA standards, those kind of things. If they erect an unfair barrier, they can be sued.
Why do we have to replace NAFTA? So NAFTA has been devastating to working people. Under just one government program, 910,000 specific Americans have been certified as having lost their jobs to NAFTA since its existence. 910,000. If you go to tradewatch.org, our website, to the Trade Data Center, through a Freedom of Information Act standing order, we have the entire database, and we have it searchable. You can put in your zip code, your town, the kind of jobs, the company, and you can search those almost a million Americans who lost their jobs to NAFTA. Number two, even if you don't lose your job, when you wash out that many higher wage manufacturing jobs, you put downward pressure on everyone's wages. So all of us have seen lower wages, and particularly for the two-thirds of the working public who don't have college degrees, we've seen wages suppressed because you have a million plus just from NAFTA, 5 million totally from our current trade policies, manufacturing workers who lost their jobs in the last 20 years. They're now in the pool competing for the same kinds of jobs that a person without a college degree can get. Pushes down wages across the economy. And here's a shocker. We even have a trade deficit in agriculture under NAFTA. Small farmers have been clobbered. We've lost over 200,000 independent farms since NAFTA. We went from a $2.4 billion trade surplus with Mexico and Canada to a $6.8 billion deficit. We even have a deficit, the cowboy nation, in beef with their NAFTA partners. So basically, the big guys, the packing houses when it comes to agriculture, the big multinational companies that relocated to lower wages, they've done great. But working people, communities, the environment's been a disaster. And why the environment? Why communities? Because at the heart of NAFTA is investor-state dispute settlement. You can see my NISDS. That's the technical name for a system that literally gives thousands of multinational corporations the power to sue the U.S. government in front of a tribunal of three corporate attorneys. The lawyers can order the U.S. government, us, the taxpayers, to pay unlimited sums, including the company's future expected profits, for any action, government action, court action, regulation, that they say violates their new corporate rights in NAFTA. And those decisions of the lawyers are not subject to appeal. Almost $400 million has been paid out in NAFTA attacks alone on timber policy, water policy, tax expands, investor state dispute settlement, ISDS. It is the dirty secret at the heart of TPP. It is at the heart of NAFTA. That's where it started. It's raw corporate power. Thanks to NAFTA, Canada has lost more of those investor state attacks on its environmental laws than any other developed country. Just to give some examples.
Okay, I'm going to dump out of that. She gives an example, but we're running out of time, and I want to get to the pertinent stuff here. She goes on to talk about the devastating effects of NAFTA on Mexico. And see, that's the thing a lot of us overlook. It hasn't been favorable to people in Mexico either.
Mexico has seen more than 2 million peasant family farms destroyed by the dumping of subsidized corn. But it literally gutted, devastated the rural societies in Mexico. But as well, NAFTA has rules that allowed for the first time the Walmarts and the Kmarts to come in. So there were over a million medium-sized manufacturers and retail facilities that were also destroyed. That movement's called El Barzón. It's the word for the yoke on the ox. It is a movement of middle-class Mexicans who thought NAFTA would be good for them, who also got screwed. Only the biggest of the biggest actually won out. And so much more damage. So we are flooded with imported food that doesn't meet U.S. standards, because under NAFTA, all three countries have to accept stuff. Our GMO stuff going to the other countries, food that doesn't meet our standards going here, you have to accept it. And NAFTA got rid of bans, waves, Buy America, Buy American, and Buy Local. That means if folks in Georgia or any other state decide they want to invest their state tax dollars into creating jobs, creating innovation, incentivizing some policies, like we want labor unions in this contract, you can't set those kind of conditions. You can't have buy local. Why the hell is that even in NAFTA? As well as all kinds of limits on the regulation of trucks, energy, banking, you name it. NAFTA is not mainly about trade. And it's ongoing damage. Every day, if you look in the news, you see more jobs being offshore. Why? Because NAFTA has incentives that literally make it cheaper and easier to offshore. Because Mexican wages are horrifically low. Talk about a tri-national screw job for working people. Since NAFTA, wages in Mexico are 9% lower. 9% lower in real terms. That's $1,400 less.
Okay, I want to dump out of it there, but she's saying, I will put the link in the show notes to that whole conference as well, because there were a lot of important things said there, and I think it's real easy for us, because we know our pain, it's real easy for us to think that NAFTA has benefited Mexico, and in this coming hearing, if we get to it, we'll hear just people, you know, some of these jerks that are promoting NAFTA and promoting not pulling out of it say that, oh, Mexico stands to lose nearly a million jobs. Well, she just said that we lost nearly a million jobs. So whose jobs are they?
Yeah. Well, you know what? A long time ago, I read that Mexico benefited initially, but then the companies that were there, then they moved to China, you know, because China had even lower wages than Mexico did. So it's a global race to the bottom.
Exactly.
And in my research, I track this back to the World Bank. The World Bank is the one, and Willy Brandt, he was the socialist in, you know, that initiated all of these studies that led to really the building of the globalization of the global management system. So I really believe that it's the World Bank that is behind all of this.
Yeah, I wanted to
look at things.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, because they look at things in an abstract way.
Mm-hmm.
People don't matter. They're looking at money. They're looking at processes and flows.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So I wanted to provide some of that as background to bring us to where we are today. You know, in recent weeks, it now appears that the NAFTA negotiations are not going well. You mentioned China. I think that's going to be the issue because we have an administration right now that's very China-friendly, despite his campaign rhetoric about how he's going to label China a currency manipulator and all this other stuff. We're still waiting, Mr. Trump. We're still waiting. And I think we're going to be waiting for a very long time. The point is,
that's very disappointing to me to hear you say that, because I know that Trump knows about China and the building of the inland ports. What they did in our country with these intermodal commerce zones. Let me back up a little bit and say, when Gorbachev did his New World Order speech, he talked about an international division of labor. And apparently, in the international division of labor, they gave China the control of ports and the transportation system, because we talked about the China's One Belt, One Road strategy last week. Well, the control of the ports includes the surveillance technology to surveil all of us. Okay, so basically they're turning over control of the management systems to China, which kind of makes sense if you separate everything out. They have the manpower.
Yeah, and I read just recently that China has a lot of cameras here in the United States being used for surveillance.
Sure, yes, because I'll bet you every single one of them is in a port, is in what would be counted as an international port zone for international commerce.
Yeah, I don't doubt that one bit. I mean, it's really astounding how the progress, and ladies and gentlemen, this is what it are the consequences. You know, all the time that you talk to people and they say, well, none of that affects me. That doesn't matter to me. Are you starting to see how it affects you now?
Absolutely affects everybody.
Yeah.
And it affects the future of our country, if we want to have a country. If we want to be serfs living in a state of feudalism, if that's the world we want to leave to our grandchildren, then just...
do nothing.
Go shopping.
Yep. Bottom of the hour. We'll be back. This is Govern America.
In a recent closed-door speech to donors, politicians, and media, Bill Clinton spoke about American gun owners. Quote, a lot of these people, all they've got is their hunting and their fishing, or they've been listening to this stuff for so long that they believe it all, unquote. And we all remember Barack Obama's 2008 comments to a room of San Francisco elites. Quote, "It's not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion." Unquote. The arrogance of their superiority requires this reminder. They don't rule us. They don't give us rights. We grant them power. They don't make us safe. We pay to protect them. They don't make us free. We're free already. And as long as we have the Second Amendment, we always will be. We are America. And our politicians are only as powerful as we, the people, allow them to be.
American News this hour, I'm Darren Weeks. Another key member of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe appears to have deep ties with the Democratic Party. Aaron Zebley is part of a long list of Democrats populating Mueller's team that are working to bring down President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the gun publication Ammoland is questioning what Robert Mueller knows about the gun running operation known as Fast and Furious, which led to the death of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry and others. Mueller was asked to stay on at the FBI by Barack Obama just as the Operation Fast and Furious investigations by the Senate were heating up. Mueller has expressed his contempt for the Second Amendment by condemning the Supreme Court's Heller decision. In a statement, Mueller said that he is against anyone having firearms except law enforcement and the military. The U.S. Department of Energy is funding MIT research to develop plants that glow in hopes to someday create plants that could illuminate whole living rooms and sidewalks from the light of their leaves. Michael Strano, senior author of the study, says the light is powered by the energy metabolism of the plant itself. Researchers infuse the plants with luciferase, the same enzyme that makes fireflies glow. Right now, the plants give off a dim light for 4 hours. They're not quite strong enough to replace a lamp yet, but the researchers are hoping they'll be able to advance to the point of being able to create plants that emit enough light to illuminate a workspace or trees that double as streetlights. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is pushing Indians to link their digital IDs to a host of services such as credit cards and cell phones, even as the Supreme Court decides the scope of the world's largest biometric database. Almost 1 billion people had signed up for the program before a landmark privacy ruling in August strengthened the case against making the ID mandatory. That's the news this hour. I'm Darren Weeks.
One of the most popular movies during the Christmas season is the old favorite, It's a Wonderful Life. It's the story of George Bailey, a compassionate but dejected businessman who is ready to give up on life when his guardian angel, Clarence, intervenes. Clarence shows him life as if George had never been born, and George discovers that for all his supposed mistakes and failures, he has brought joy and life to countless people. It really is a wonderful life, and not just on TV. Each and every person has so much potential for good, and nowhere is this potential greater than with an unborn child. This Christmas, and always, please work to preserve the wonder of life for the unborn and their mothers. This has been a perspective on life from National Right to Life. For more information, visit our website at nrlc.org. That's nrlc.org.
All right, we're in the home stretch of the broadcast, final half hour of the show, and what is I always describe as the fastest 3 hours in talk radio. This is Govern America, governamerica.com. Vicki Davis is here, thetechnocratictyranny.com, and channelingreality.com. As we get back into this, we're talking about the NAFTA renegotiation that's taking place right now, and apparently it's not doing very well. And there's talk now and a lot of hand-wringing on the part of these public officials who, you know, former ambassadors and trade representatives about the possibility that that the United States might actually pull out of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And they were discussing recently in a panel discussion about just what would happen, what were the consequences, what could it be. And this is Carla Hills that you're going to hear from first. She's up first at the podium talking about
some of the consequences as she sees it.
The last round, the United States put forward some proposals that actually have been what...
Hold on, that's the wrong clip. I'm sorry. Here's Carla Hills.
I think in starting to think about what we lose from a pullout of the NAFTA, we ought to remember, what did the agreement do for us? And so let me briefly say, it brought together 490 million consumers and created a $19 trillion market. It eliminated tariffs on all industrial goods and most agricultural goods, except for a few, with Canada. It opened a broad range of services, including financial services, and provided national treatment for our service providers across line. It removed significant investment barriers and provided protection for our North American investors, and it provided enforceable protection for trademarks, patent rights, and copyright, which have become more important in the 20 years since. And as a result, our commercial relationships throughout North America expanded, making this region the most competitive in the world. Today, Canada and Mexico account for one-third of our global trade. But we're not to talk about trade. We're talking about what happens if it shrinks. And actually, I want to also mention that Canada is our largest export destination and Mexico is our second largest. And the number of and vibrancy of these commercial relationships have created bonds, great bonds, people to people and government to government, paying dividends in areas way beyond trade.
It's created bonds, all right. Think of shackles, ladies and gentlemen.
For example, visitors from Canada and Mexico constitute the top two sources of tourism, a major industry for the United States. In 2015, contributed $1.5 trillion to our economy. Today, one out of nine jobs are hinged to tourism. A decrease in tourism has already occurred in this year as a result of concerns about the breakdown in our regional relationship. Another cost from withdrawal would be a decrease in inward investment. Our NAFTA partners have invested $280 billion in the United States, and the uncertainty created by the threat of our walking away from the agreement after 24 years, without question, will reduce interest in investments and jobs connected to investments. And not just from our northern and southern neighbors, much more broadly. Uncertainty with respect to our future action also affects our job creation. And think of it. In 1993, our jobs connected to Mexico totaled 700,000. Today, as a result of the NAFTA, it's 5 million. Exiting from the NAFTA would obviously cause that number to shrink very significantly. And you take the auto sector. We would lose jobs if we break up our highly synchronized supply chains.
This is my favorite part right here.
The highly synchronized supply chain.
Yeah, yeah.
Break up our highly synchronized supply chains that have made our auto industry the most competitive globally.
Yeah, it's all gone to Mexico. It's all gone to Mexico. And we're going to lose jobs.
We do import components back for assembly. See, it's the same model as Boeing,
mm-hmm.
And it is a central planning of the global economy. It's designed to create interdependencies between economic zones, you know, calling our country an economic zone and not a nation state. But it is designed to build an interlocking global system that countries will not be able to break out of. If we don't break out of it now, we will not be able to in the future.
Right.
After a pullout, our companies would see their costs increase, adversely affect their global competitiveness, and result in a decrease in our sales, which would mean fewer jobs. Some companies might, and are predicted to, relocate to Asia, which again would adversely affect jobs.
I can't believe this woman is actually using a loss of jobs as justification to keep NAFTA. It talk about being out of touch. I mean, all these people. Go ahead.
I think they're psychotic. There really is something totally fundamentally wrong with their brain.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, they're affected. See, that's the thing. It doesn't touch them, and they're thinking in terms of regions, where we're thinking in terms of the whole country.
Right, of country, of life, of family, of living a life worth living.
Right.
She is a person who is looking at, she probably worked for the World Bank or you know, in some banking or something, you know, because to be a trade negotiator, negotiating these global trade agreements, you have to not have any country loyalty, loyalty to your family or your country or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's for sure. And I don't doubt that, you know. Well, she probably is one of these people that are thinking that her family is going to be taken care of. But maybe she generally doesn't care about anybody else. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case at all.
Or take the agricultural sector. We've got 10 states that are keenly related to what they produce in the agricultural markets. And the tariffs, then the food sector, the bound tariffs, are above 30%. So our farm states would truly feel the pinch. In addition to the harm done to our regional relationship, we would suffer challenges in maintaining security. For the past two decades, our three governments have worked together to handle the increased flow of trade, trying to separate the ways to those items that would create a danger, and so they could focus on facilitating those items which there is no concern. And today we share intelligence and collaborate on confronting challenges running from narcotics to international crime to various areas of organized crime, and creating a stronger border requires attention and action on both sides of a border.
Can you believe she's actually trying to say that NAFTA creates a strong border?
Yeah, she's really reaching for that one, isn't she?
The whole purpose of NAFTA is a border elimination. The harmonization of various things, you know, agencies, police forces, as they're talking about working with security measures, harmonization of regulations. It's all about eliminating the border. It's unbelievable, some of the things that they say here to try to justify keeping NAFTA. So,
yeah. She's just a fundamentally dishonest person.
I think I'm going to skip the next clip in the interest of time, Vicki, because I want to get into some of the meat and potatoes of the rest of this hearing. We have Earl Anthony Wayne, who is the former U.S. Deputy Ambassador to Afghanistan.
Well, I think the basic message is that things would cost more. Cars could cost a couple thousand dollars more if we went out of our North American production chain. The winter vegetables you get from Mexico would probably cost a little bit more, maybe not be as available. We don't know what will happen in agricultural trade. So day to day, that would probably be the place that people note things. Mm-hmm. In general, I think we would also see, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, we'd see a reduction in security cooperation and fighting crime.
Yeah, we can't work with the Mexicans unless we have NAFTA. We have to have NAFTA in order to do anything, I guess. But here's cutting to the meat of the discussion. There's a lot of talk about, you know, devastating this and devastating that. You know, the world's going to end if we pull out of NAFTA, despite the fact that we didn't have NAFTA before 93. And we were just fine, actually much better off. This is...
And so was Mexico, by the way. Say
yeah.
That. Mexico was better off,
That's
too.
True. They had a more agrarian society. They had a lot of farmers that were run off the land. We've talked for years about how the intent of NAFTA is to eliminate the borders. And here's what Ambassador Earl Wayne says about moving to a shared paradigm.
It's important to remember that in the 1980s, the United States and Mexico were called distant neighbors. And that's because they really didn't cooperate on very much. There were individual friendships, but there wasn't a cooperative relation between the two governments. After NAFTA, what happened over the subsequent 25 years is gradually, and let me underscore, gradually, we developed more mutual trust and mutual understanding, and we started expanding the area where we were able to cooperate. It started in the trade and then financial area. Arturo and I wrote a paper about in the foreign policy area how long it took. It took up through the first decade of the 2000s and then beyond to get us to a point where we were willing to look at collaborating around the world and in other places. And the same is true in the security area. There was just not mutual trust or mutual understanding between the security agencies. They would work together on specific cases, but it was limited. And the same thing on the border. Up until just a few years ago, people were still shouting at each other across the border.
Finger pointing.
Pointing fingers. And what they did is they moved to a shared paradigm of shared responsibilities. We share the responsibility for solving these really difficult problems.
It's called integration, ladies and gentlemen.
Neither of us can do it by ourselves. In the law enforcement security area, starting in 2008 with the Merit Initiative and moving forward, increasingly every year there was better collaboration. They didn't solve all the problems, but they found new ways to address those problems that were more effective. A lot of that is endangered by what Arturo was talking about, that public attitudes in both countries, really, but also in Mexico, where you just don't have the space to do those kind of steps forward, and your own law enforcement people are going to be less trustworthy because of what they perceive to be clear insults, not against the criminals, but against Mexico in general.
Okay, I'm going to cut out of that in the interest of time and go to the next one. Because if the language of moving to a shared paradigm with shared responsibility wasn't enough, Canadian ambassador to the United States, Michael Wilson, he states it more bluntly.
I think Tony has said something that is very, very important. What NAFTA has done has brought our three countries together, not just Mexico and the United States, but also Canada, Mexico, and the United States. After a NAFTA termination, that will dissipate, no question of that. So we are concerned about that, not to the same extent because we aren't so as directly as affected, but we are concerned about a dissipation of the strong relationship that has built over the last 25 years between Canada, between Mexico and the United States. The other point, it's a broader point here, what's the message to the rest of the world? If the United States can't get along with their two neighbors, Mexico and Canada, and they have to destroy a trade agreement which has done tremendous positive results for all three countries, if they can't get together with their two neighbors, how are they going to be able to get together with other countries in other parts of the world?
Yeah, and we should be worried about that, right? I mean,
right.
Go ahead.
That cooperation, let's never, ever forget that it was a Canadian general who was monitoring the skies on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his failure, the reason why we didn't have protection in our skies.
Well, standing down, frankly. Because that's
right.
We know good and well, NORAD was ordered to stand down. And there's no way in the most...
Canadian general, our good friend, a Canadian general who was in charge.
Yeah. Well, and they're talking about in this hearing about admitting Mexico to NORAD. He talks about one of the ambassadors, I think it's the Mexican ambassador to the United States, says that he thinks Mexico should be allowed to join NORAD. That's been talked about. And he says, you know, I was able to bring Mexican troops into Colorado as a part of, you know, so that we have peacekeeping efforts, peacekeeping operations. They call them PKOs.
Yeah, right. Well, and it was Mexico, Vicente Fox, who made a deal with the communist Chinese for ports in southern Mexico so that they could bring goods, you know, depending on our good Mexican friends to ensure that we don't have any contraband, let's say contraband, coming from Mexico up into the United States into directly into the foreign trade zones.
Yeah.
So these people, these globalists that think this is so great, they think it's great because they consider the nation state an obsolete construct. Mm-hmm. And they want to destroy it.
Yes, and that's exactly what they're working to do. You're right. These free trade agreements are about regional integration. We sound like a broken record. What is integration? Pieces coming together to form a whole. They're about merging agencies, regulations, laws, and resources across borders with the ultimate goal of merging the countries, merging the different governmental entities together. And with that in mind, we listen carefully to what he says about harmonization.
Final point, in 2011, President Obama and Prime Minister Harper launched something, I think it's Beyond the Borders, so it's the name of the negotiation. Anyway, it focus on border management and harmonization of regulation. And a lot of that was done very quietly, below the radar screen, but a lot of good things has come out of that over the course of this time.
Below the radar screen. Why would it be done below the radar screen? Do you think it might be because the people, if they ever found out you were merging their country with two other countries, they might be a little upset?
I would worry that the momentum that we had that arose from that 2011 agreement would decline, and possibly we might see things in reverse. Not as direct an impact between Canada and the United States as between the United States and Mexico, but certainly we would not be immune from the concerns that have been expressed by Arturo and Tony.
You know, it's funny to watch all this hand-wringing by these New World Order globalists, Vicky, but the hand-wringing is all lopsided. Why aren't they worried about, you know, they're worried about multinational corporations, you know, being impacted by the NAFTA pullout. They're worried about jobs, but the trouble is the jobs they're worried about are Mexican jobs. No one on this panel is ever talking about American jobs, the American workers who have been impacted negatively by NAFTA. Many of us have been destroyed.
The reason why is because the objective of global engineering of the global economy is classic communism, redistribution of wealth. And they've taken it from the American middle class, from the working people in the United States, and they have distributed it all over the world. The manufacturing to China, IT jobs to India, some manufacturing to Mexico, but they've engineered it for, it's kind of like a managed decline in the standard of living for the American people.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. A managed slow boil where your wealth is slowly boiled away.
Yes.
And your freedoms, too, along with it. They go on to talk about...
Right along with...
Yeah, they go on to talk about the elections in Mexico and how that could be affected by a pullout.
If the U.S. pulls out of NAFTA before the election, it will change the tenor of the debate. The estimates are that Mexico could lose anywhere between 900,000 and 1.2 million jobs.
1.2 million jobs. How many jobs did Lori Wallach say earlier that we lost to Mexico? She says it was nearly a million.
If NAFTA were ended, that is going to be something candidates will have to take a position on. They're going to have to change that agenda. And if jobs rise up in the agenda and people are fearful about the future of their economy, that means other things will be relatively less important. I think Arturo's right that those main anti-corruption themes are going to be right up there in front, and then I think violence and crime in the country. But you're going to have next to it a whole different debate about what do you do about the future economy of Mexico? Mm-hmm. How quickly can you develop new export sources? What impact is this going to be to have on Mexican citizens? And you're not going to have anybody championing cooperation with the United States. Even those candidates who personally might believe that, they're just not going to have the space to do that. And those who may personally not believe it anyway will be a bit more aggressive and nationalistic in their response, because you're protecting your electorate. You're protecting your Mexican citizens.
Yeah, and nobody cares about the United States citizens. Nobody's right. Championing our cause. It's so maddening.
These globalists, they are hurting working people all over the world. It's not just, I'm partisan for America, but the truth of the matter is that they are, between the trade agreements and the technology, they are hurting people all over the world.
Absolutely. Now, earlier we were talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership related to the NAFTA negotiations. We talked about how it seems like now that the plan was to roll the TPP into NAFTA. This was confirmed, actually, by the panelists.
I think the sine qua non to coming up with an upgraded 2.0, 3.0 free trade agreement is to jettison the my way or the highway approach to negotiations and the zero-sum mechanics with which this administration has approached most of the issues in the negotiation itself. You have to get rid of sunset clauses. It's absurd. A sunset clause runs counter to why you have a free trade agreement in the first place. You're not going to sign a free trade agreement if every 5 years, and if you're a company and you're going to invest, you're not going to do it if every 5 years you're going to have to renegotiate the agreement. So you've got to get rid of the sunset clause, and you should do no harm. You should do no harm to the joint supply and production platforms that we've created in North America, which have allowed us to compete and which have ensured that not more jobs have been lost in the American heartland. It also means that we do what we were trying to do with TPP. TPP, when Canada and Mexico decided to join TPP, TPP, at the end of the day, the reason why Canada and Mexico joined was that this was the best way to upgrade NAFTA without having to renegotiate NAFTA, because by adhering to 21st century standards on stuff that didn't exist when we negotiated NAFTA, Tony's mentioned it, e-commerce and digital and IPR and biotech issues. By modernizing TPP and having Canada, Mexico, and the United States be TPP members, it would have automatically renewed the regulatory framework with which we trade without having to even say NAFTA and renegotiate. The fact that many of the disciplines that negotiators are looking at today come from the TPP itself, I think, is an indication of what a modernized, upgraded free trade agreement between the three countries that improves our ability to compete looks like.
There you go. I mean, he said it right there, ladies and gentlemen. They needed an update to NAFTA. Along comes Trump, and he promotes getting rid of NAFTA or renegotiating NAFTA. So one way or the other, the plan moves forward. Do you see how everybody is being conned here? He just said it. The TPP was supposed to be their way of updating NAFTA to the 21st century. And so Trump comes in and promotes the idea of renegotiating NAFTA, And he kills TPP because it was very unpopular, but we already know some of the things are being rolled into it. So whether we pull out of NAFTA or not, I think ultimately they're going to piecemeal, if they have to, all of these trade policies into some sort of an agreement, which people are going to end up getting stuck with. That's just my take on it. And we're just about out of time.
Ultimately, the objective is to have the United Nations be the management center. The World Bank will control banking. The IMF has some part in that. They're building a world for commerce, not for people, and that makes people slaves.
Yes.
Back to a system of feudalism where you are a slave.
Yeah. That's it. That's where we're headed, ladies and gentlemen. And on that happy note, thanks for being with us.
We always do that, don't we?
Yes, we do. I'm sorry. But we give you doses of reality, folks, and that should make you a happy slave, at least. If you talk against it, educate your fellow brethren and sisterin, and join us back here next week and bring somebody with you. You know, because the truth is you got to start from the standpoint of truth if you ever hope to achieve being free, set free from the servitude. Well, God bless you, folks. Thanks, Vicki, as always. Pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. And join us back here next week. Same time, same outlet.
And thank you, Darren.
Yep, thank you.
Bye, everybody.
We'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.
Truth for the restoration.